The Honorable Samantha Peckham.
Mr. Speaker, another term after our resounding election success and the public vote of confidence, and with the challenges that lie ahead here. But we are a strong team, Mr. Speaker, and together we will work as hard as we need to serve and to deliver. Mr. Speaker, as you know, I have an extremely broad portfolio. It is impossible for me to list all the achievements in this past financial year. I will highlight the most notable matters, and that is not to say that anything that I may not specifically mention is any less important. Mr. Speaker, I will commence my intervention outlining achievements in my tourism portfolio. Now more than ever, the development of our tourism industry is essential. Since the referendum, we have had a very busy week indeed, reassuring our industry partners that it is business as usual in Gibraltar. Our administration has already presided over a huge boom in Gibraltar in recent years. We have seen growth in an industry that has been greatly boosted as a result of our efforts. Our vision from the outset was to prioritize tourism as a key sector for the sustained development of our local economy, and we have demonstrated our political commitment to tourism growth. We believe that the tourism sector in Gibraltar suffered from underinvestment, was underdeveloped, and as such, it was not the economic driver that it ought to be. My predecessor, Minister Gosper, quickly set about to change that in the start of our first term of office. Our government has invested in the massive untapped potential and taken Gibraltar to new and impressive heights. In our second term, I will continue with the same vision and determination and vigour as I did in the last. We are invested heavily in what we have no doubt is a unique tourist project. We have worked closely with our tourism partners and stakeholders in our community and internationally, and we have transformed our service. The Apéro is a unique feature we have to offer and is certainly recognized as the jewel in our family. The tourist board's unprecedented investment in exciting the Apéro and the transformation of the nature reserve, led by the Department of Environment and Climate Change, and of course my colleague Minister Bishop, has been a game changer in upgrading our city. The restoration of the themed country trails and footpaths, and the addition of some innovative attractions. The most impressive is certainly the Windsor Suspension Bridge at Royal Anglian Way, and its breathtaking and a tremendous engineering feat, which we opened just a few weeks ago. And we will shortly be adding a further attraction when we open the glass skywalk viewing platform, which is perched near the rock summit. It will provide striking panoramic vistas of the majestic geography surrounding Gibraltar, and I look forward to the inauguration of that tourism system. The Northern Defence is another important new addition, and we heard the Deputy Chief Minister describe to us on Tuesday this beautiful place of great military significance and heritage value, but which for decades was merely a dumping ground for anything that could be thrown over the wall. Wonderful addition to our visitor attractions, which of course, my tourist board is already busy marketing. Symbolically, they are enduring symbols of our government's commitment to improve tourism. Our plan for growth has been strategic and has been focused primarily on niche markets such as the wedding and the mountains. And one of the most successful niche markets is our event-led tourism strategy. We have become adept at organising first-class cultural events that are thoroughly enjoyed by everyone here and which act as a magnet for visitors. On the back of these intense and high-profile occasions, the Gibraltar leisure and hospitality industry has been able to take advantage of the interest generated by the tourists they attract. It has been an important tool in our revitalised tourism strategy, and these influence helps exploit the resources. I work very closely with our then Minister Linnell, and the tourist board works closely in turn with the Ministry for Culture, which takes the lead in organising these fantastic events with the tourist board market. But the tourist board is responsible for organising this event for Gibraltar Literary Festival. And while the quality and high standards appear effortless to everyone attending, this is no mean feat to organise. The festival has become one of our flagship events and will enjoy its fourth edition this autumn. It has become firmly established and its popularity continues to increase as does its status. testimony to the field in such a short period of time is that we have been fortunate and are thrilled and honoured that earlier this year, Her Royal Highness the Princess Royal agreed to the sanction of the festival. The status, of course, also provides us with fantastic international exposure, which attracts high-level participants and visitors. Our festival attracts the constellation of authors, poets, and renowned speakers. We have already announced over 20 speakers who will be participating in this year's festival, and we are already engaging in intense marketing of the event in so many meetings. As part of our vigorous marketing campaign of this event, it is interesting to note that last year the festival received a radio audience of 2 million in the UK. Commercial radio outlets and 7 BBC radio channels between Scotland and the Channel Islands featured the festival and included extended interviews with a couple of the main speakers. Mr. Speaker, I wish to thank our principal sponsor, Tivanti, and all sponsors, who by doing so make the event viable and contribute to enriching our cultural group. Also, we have upgraded and rebranded our marketing strategy, and this is also contributing to our success. We have an excellent cruise project, Mr. Speaker, and we want to show it, and we are continually looking for more efficient and effective ways of marketing this project. We actively participate in various forums and are continuously looking to establish new partnerships, such as the ITC conference that I attended in Tel Aviv last month. We will be hosting the next two conferences next year, another wonderful platform for promotion. Mr. Speaker, I'm delighted to report that we have already seen return on our investment and growth in the sector. Our figures are up year on year, so clearly the improvements that I have outlined have had a positive effect on our visit to London. I am pleased to say that the last public statistics show the arrivals of the presidency. In fact, we have the highest numbers since 2007. We are achieving our objective, Mr. Speaker, and our transformed tourist product is translated into growth. The most notable growth since we were elected is human aviation. This sector continues to report very healthy findings in all categories, catering for the needs of both the business and the leisure travel. Inbound and outgoing air passengers and establishments have increased in the last 3 months. Today, we have more flights to the UK than ever before. Just last Sunday, we saw the arrival of the inaugural EasyJet flight from Manchester. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, when I was at the airport last Sunday, I was delighted to see the departure line busier than I have ever seen. The additional flight from New York we have secured, among us, Birmingham flight, the new EasyJet route to Bristol, Manchester, along with Royal and Royal service to Tango and Casablanca. And these have generated extra passengers. And in specific terms, Mr. Speaker, this summer alone, we have seen a 40.8% growth in capacity and a weekly flight increase of 31.5% compared to last year, which in itself was a record year. Among other highlights of this past year have been EasyJet's achievement in attending the tremendous milestone last August of carrying 1 million passengers on the Gibraltar to London Gatwick route. And we look forward to welcoming another million of people. The Gibraltar Bristol link carries 35,000 passengers in its first year and is proven extremely successful. I am also delighted to report that EasyJet is set to provide extra seat capacity between Gibraltar and London Gatwick by 15% in summer season, and an additional 13,000 places being made available in part this year. Overall, this airline will operate 18 weekly flights to Gibraltar this summer season, up from 14 last summer. We are extremely pleased about the close working relationship that we have established with EasyJet of late, which has enabled us to establish new routes. Given the commitment to Gibraltar, we continue to work closely with them on further growth and look forward to being able to introduce new routes in due course. Additional capacity has also been provided by another long-standing partner of ours, British Airways, with two extra weekly flights, the London Heathrow Gibraltar flight, which commenced on the 1st of May this year, bringing the total number of flights on the route to 13 a week. Monarch also launched their London Gatwick Gibraltar route in May, this year offering 4 flights a week, and this is the airline's 4th future destination from Gibraltar. In summary, Mr. Speaker, over the summer months, Gibraltar will offer 17 weekly flights from London Gatwick, up from 11 last year. 14 weekly flights from London to Heathrow, up from 9. 5 was replaced from London Luton. 6 was replaced from Manchester, up from 4. 4 was replaced from Birmingham, up from 3. 3 was replaced from Bristol. 2 was replaced from London Tiger. This represents no less than 50 flights a week, up from 37 in the summer of 2015. Mr. Speaker, you will be pleased to know that we recorded our busiest summer in 2015, and in the period of July to August, we recorded over 35,000 passengers each month. This represents an increase of 12.7% against July 2014, and 10% above the August figures. Importantly, visitor arrivals by air increased by 7.1% in 2015 over 2014. Mr. Speaker, we have recorded an increase of 22% in passenger flows in the first 5 months of 2016 compared with the same period in 2015. May was already a record month with 49,483 passengers processed, beating even the record number from last August. With the main summer holiday period still so close, further records are expected to be registered in the next few months. Mr. Speaker, I wish to emphasize at this juncture that the substantial increase in airline activity has come as a result principally due to our ability to demand, to generate demand for devoted bound seats, and on a broader scale, on our political forefront in making tourism a priority, and our success in developing and massively upgrading our local source product. It is not, as your position would have you believe, due to the new airport terminal on which they will be overturned. I take it for a unit to speak of it as a remedy. Gibraltar is one of the most diverse ports in the Mediterranean. Any objective observer closely following the development of Gibraltar's food industry in recent years would agree that the Rock is experiencing a golden age of food. In 2015, we ranked third in terms of countries that experienced an increase in the number of food footfalls with a growth of 12.7%. Our extraordinary accomplishment on this front is backed by hard evidence as the number of footfalls, food inaugurals, and passenger visits continue to grow year after year. We really do have something to offer for all types of customers and visitors in the world. In 2015, we had 13 food inaugurals, 204 food days, and 295,922 passenger visits. In 2016, the World Report is scheduled to receive 225 people, a 10.3% increase on last year, carrying an estimated 344,415 passengers to the Rock, and no less than a record of 18 inaugural cruises. Arrival prices have this year increased by 14.2%, and that includes yet arrivals, which have increased by 8%. The robust upward trend reflects the healthy state of the industry and consolidates the growth registered in 2015, which was in turn a sizable improvement in 2014, 183 states. A notable development in 2016 is that Nova Caledonia has chosen Gibraltar as a turnaround port. This is the super represents a major breakthrough, and there will be two turnarounds this year, one in October and another in November. It must be noted that growth also demonstrates that we can successfully handle some of the last vessels ever built, including the Royal Caribbean Division of the Seas. This progress demonstrates the confidence that the industry has in the region. And we look forward to continuing our business partnership with some of the most prestigious cruise lines in the world. Mr. Speaker, in 2015, visitor numbers to the Upper Rock registered an 8% increase in respect of 2014, reaching a record-breaking figure of 858,508. To end May 2015, visitor numbers to the Upper Rock have increased by 13.64% over last year. April this year is the only month to attain a decrease, and this year attributes to Easter falling at the end of March, which showed a significant increase in the same month the previous year. Mr. Speaker, it is clear that whether it be arrivals by land, increased air travel, or cruise line passengers, it can be said that the international leisure industry firmly has Gibraltar in its sights. Mr. Speaker, Gibraltar has strengthened its position in the global market as a leading port-based destination and port of call in the Western Mediterranean. Mr. Speaker, we will continue our determination that this sector grows as an economic driver, and of course, we are committed to work tirelessly on this front with our partners and stakeholders, to stimulate further growth and expansion. We are determined to ensure that the positive outcomes experienced in the past 12 months continue unabated. We will continue to diversify and, of course, without a shadow of a doubt, the message is clear insofar as tourism, as with every other part of our strong and successful economy, Gibraltar remains open to business. Turning to housing, Mr. Speaker, I am proud to say that this past year has indeed been a landmark year on a number of fronts. In my speech last year, I referred to the affordable housing scheme that we were constructing, and this year, those have become a reality. Early in the year, we saw the completion of two magnificent affordable housing projects at Beach and Charity and Monsanto Moon. The homes are spacious and standard, and the standard of construction is indeed very high. Many families have already moved in, and I received frequent reports of how happy people are with their new homes. Exciting times for many people. And Mr. Speaker, the ingenious idea of constructing for co-ownership, thereby making it affordable and so successful and enabling people to get in the property ladder, was developed by the GSLC that we were first in office. And we continue so as to ensure that the acute demand for housing that we saw snowball in the last 20 years and not recently. The construction of a further at least 1,500 flats in the next phase of construction of affordable housing, as it stands from Phoenix, in Charities and Bob Felicity, has already shown incredible interest. This, Mr. Speaker, demonstrates that there is an overwhelming desire to own property. Furthermore, I am just as proud to be part of a government that will deliver purpose-built flats for the elderly, 142 people say. The concept of building flats for the elderly is a great one. Such flats are in high demand. We have taken it to the next level in the new development of Child Reform House in Fiasco Lodge by consulting with every single relevant professional, and we have been collaborating in the planning and design to achieve the best design of the flats and learning from the mistakes of the existing accommodation for the elderly. These flats incorporate the latest accessibility features, space for style, colour contrast for the benefit of the elderly and large, non-slip tiles and individual tile patterns. The design of the building takes account of wheelchair users, includes ramps, automatic doors and lifts. Regrettably, Mr. Speaker, you will recall that we had to go to considerable expense in alterations to remedy defects, preventing accessibility in either treatment and disciplining the home, as well as converting baths to showers, so as to make those flats more comfortable for the elderly tenants. Our purpose-built flats will make an incredible improvement to the quality of life of our elderly community, and will help them remain at home with dignity, comfortably, safely and independently for longer. In turn, a considerable number of larger accommodation will be returned to the government rental housing system. The first of those, Mr. Speaker, Seamaster Lodge at Moonstrike University, has just now been handed over to the government, and we shall embark on the process of allocation to applicants very shortly. So no time at all, Mr. Speaker, those individuals who have applied for this flat will be hearing from. All in all, the first phase of construction of flats by our government have given the people of Gibraltar in excess of 1,000 new homes. Needless to say that this will in turn have a considerable impact on the housing waiting list. In addition, there will also be flats returned to the rental stock for individuals who have purchased or who may be moving into the flats for the elderly. In addition to the new construction, we continue with our extensive refurbishment program of existing government rental housing estates, which, as we heard on Tuesday, the enhancement has converted these into assets by way of a nation. The major refurbishment work with Blackwood and North Park of the state are virtually complete and have undeniably contributed to visually transforming what was previously dreary and neglected architecture of the Gibraltar's land end system. Phases 1 and 2 at Laguna State are practically complete, and phase 3 is already being staged in. Again, the improvement of the state for revisiting. Refurbishment works with our amazing state of this interim, and the blocks remaining will be completed in this term. An extensive refurbishment program is also underway at Newton and Barrett as well as the road. The general embellishment, resurfacing, and parking rationalization work provided by the state is now complete. Mr. Speaker, refer this network to other neighbours. Faith will also continue, and we are committed to an ongoing programme of maintenance and improvement of our rental housing stock. We have invested, and we will continue to invest, in the maintenance and our people are safe for the benefit of the families to live in them. Mr. Speaker, the Chief Minister announced in Tuesday that housing rents will be increased for the first time since 1986. Mr. Speaker, you will be aware that the Ombudsman, in his report, called for the need to review housing rents. Since the announcement by the Chief Minister, this step has been widely accepted and indeed welcomed, perhaps more on a matter of principle than the value of the income that is generated. After all, Mr. Speaker, the increase is relatively minimal and modest by all accounts. I will take the liberty of reminding the House of the statistics that the Chief Minister provides on Tuesday. Average earnings in 1984 were £126 a week. Average earnings in 2015 were £555 a week. That is a rise of 340.5%. Inflation in that time has risen by 153.5%. Therefore, the increase in rent, 3%, is therefore considerably lower than if it had been increased in line with inflation. I will continue to look at the figures and provide an income statistic versus the affordability comparison. In 1984, rent at £18.70 was 14.8%, and at income rates in 2015, the cost of the same rent, because of course it's not changed, was 3.4%. On this basis, if the same proportion of income was expended on rent, the rent in 2015 should now be £82.14 per flat per week, and if rent from 1984 had been adjusted for actual inflation in 2015, they would have risen to a level of £47.40 per flat per week. Mr. Speaker, it's all relative too, as £100 in April 1984 is the equivalent of £263.36 per week. So all in all, Mr. Speaker, a very modest increase indeed. And on average, Mr. Speaker, we can make something of 60% a week. And the increase in rent, Mr. Speaker, of 3% will take effect as from the 1st of September this year, and tenants will be notified accordingly. As an aside, Mr. Speaker, very important, tenants paying rent or their debit spending order or other methods of deduction must remember to make arrangements for the payment of the new rent once due and to adjust their payment mandate. Otherwise, Mr. Speaker, heaven forbid, we would not want any rental inadvertently falling for years from the increase. Otherwise, an average of 60% will be accrued at the benefit of change. In any event, of course, the housing department will be checking this on 60%. And on the subject of arrears, Mr. Speaker, perhaps the most notable achievement in the housing department this financial year has finally seen the implementation of procedures to recover arrears of housing loans, a long-standing problem that has been festering for far too long. Before I go any further, Mr. Speaker, I wish to make one thing very clear at the outset. We are certain that there must be a distinction between those who cannot pay rent and those who do not wish to pay rent without any reason or reason. Because firm action has never been taken in the past, it has unfortunately become the norm for the latter not to pay rent. The Department is sympathetic to individuals who genuinely are unable to or have difficulty to meet their monthly renting payments, and officials try to be as helpful as possible. Unfortunately, there will always be people who are genuinely unable to pay rent, and in these circumstances, it is our duty as a community to assist. They are not the priority in our strategy for recovery of arrears. Now, Mr. Speaker, I sincerely hope that the principal auditor is listening, because I think that he will be very pleased with what I'm about to explain. He will also now, Matthew, change the template that he has been using in the auditor's report in respect of the housing department for the past 12 to 15 years. Mr. Speaker, I am proud to announce that the problem with the accrual of rent arrears and failing to collect fees is no longer. Upon my appointment as Minister for Housing just over a year and a half ago, I made it my first priority to tackle this issue that had for a long time spiraled out of control and as such suffered from the ostrich syndrome. I make the point at this stage that this is in no way a criticism of my predecessors, my friends, the late Charles Vaughan and Minister Paul Rowan. Indeed, I have been fortunate to benefit from their hard work, as they had already set about dealing with the other housing priorities, which were, of course, to lay the foundations for the construction of additional housing and plan the major refurbishment for it, the results and benefits of which we have already seen. Mr. Speaker, it is absolutely unconscionable that we find ourselves in this situation in relation to rent arrears. For too long, far too many people have considered the payment of rent as optional, or have seen it as an interest-free loan which they would never be required to repay. They have been allowed to think it and get away with it, as there has been no action taken or even an attempt to recover and no consequences for failure to pay. The collection of arrears, Mr. Speaker, is about people understanding their duty. Paying rent is about taking social and moral responsibility, and therefore, if this is not done, it is right and just that we need to see the steps. Not just because we are contractually entitled to, but it is right that we do so, because we have a duty to all other tenants who pay their rent dutifully and on time, and to all who meet their mortgage repayments, and to those taxpayers who are otherwise having to subsidize those who choose not to pay rent. Mr. Speaker, it took me the better part of a year to organize the housing department's database of non-teachers so that we could have clear information to formulate a good recovery strategy, and then work on the strategy itself so as to have a clear picture on our plan of action in the most efficient and effective way. We were finally able to embark on the recovery strategy and implement it in earnest in January this year, with a new team within the housing department dedicated almost exclusively to the recovery of rent arrears. So the majority of the figures I'm about to report are from the progress from that date. Next year, Mr. Speaker, I will be able to more properly report back for the full financial year. More or less at the same time as the self-collecting arrears, the government central arrears unit was formed, and we have also called upon them from time to time for assistance. We have a broad staff of units, Mr. Speaker, and I meet with a dedicated arrears team almost weekly to ensure that we consolidate the process and keep the momentum going. Every week, we review the position and brainstorm as to how we can improve the process further. Given the large number of debtors, we have broken them down into bands depending on the size of the debt and have varying strategies for the recovery of each band. The priority has been to recover from the top 25 debtors and everyone who owed under £1,000, as we wanted to deal with it while the debt was still manageable for them. In both cases, we ask tenants to repay a lump sum and then enter into a repayment agreement for the balance. Importantly, Mr. Speaker, in all cases of arrears where agreements have been signed, repayment is secured by direct debit, standing order, or deduction of costs in the case of public servants. We have updated our systems and databases and updated a software system for rent collection. We have introduced a new monthly billing format which highlights the arrears. We have also introduced a revised rent arrears agreement. We have embarked on an awareness campaign and introduced a facility to make lump sum payments online via the new eGov portal of up to £2,500, so that people do not have to physically attend the department to effect payment of arrears. No exchanges and students or exclusions in the tenancy are allowed for people who are in arrears. No parking spaces will be provided or renewed in places where people are in arrears. And I will use Mid Harbour Estate as an example, Mr. Speaker, only because parking permits in that estate expire on the 30th of June this year. For a number of months now, we have been writing to tenants on a number of occasions, reminding them of the requirement that arrears be paid in full in order for the parking permit to be renewed. A fob is required to activate the barrier to the car park at an estate at that estate for those who are authorised to park. Those in arrears have clearly been advised for a while now that they would no longer be authorised to park beyond the 1st of July. On the 4th of July, we deactivated the barrier fob to all those in arrears. And, Mr. Speaker, on the basis of our strategy to collect rent on arrears, in relation to this estate, which historically has suffered from big arrears problems, the total figure in arrears of which exceeds £500,000, we have collected by way of we have collected in this year £90,411, and that's just in a few months, Mr. Speaker. 39 tenants from Mid Harbour have settled their arrears in full, amounting to £84,085, and these are figures that I have as from yesterday. So, Mr. Speaker, that's just by way of example to show that the strategy is working. And these figures, Mr. Speaker, say more about the willingness to pay rent than the ability to pay rent. Because these 39 individuals have all paid what they owed in a lump sum. So, Mr. Speaker, the situation at Mid Harbour is well on its way to being improved. Similarly, Mr. Speaker, we have applied the same strategy and not allocated any sheds or beds in the new small boat marina in cases of arrears. Of those offered beds at the new marina, 32 people were in arrears. Of those, 26 people have paid in full, and in this way, we have recovered £42,747.50 in a 4-year return. And 11 debtors have actually forgone the opportunity of a new birth because they have not been willing to pay arrears. Requests for non-essential work are not accepted by the department for people in arrears. And importantly, Mr. Speaker, as from the 1st of September, it will be compulsory for all rent and arrears to be deducted at court for all public servants, unless payment is already been made by direct debit or standing order without default. It is totally unacceptable, Mr. Speaker, that people who are in employment should be indebted to their employer. This would never have been allowed, and for years, no one has implemented any mechanism to prevent it. And we now have, Mr. Speaker. Since January to date, in addition to issuing bills in the new format, which highlights that the tenancy is in arrears, the Housing Department has issued a total of 2,599 letters to debtors. This includes up to 3 or 4 letters in some cases. And in the same period, Mr. Speaker, this year, in January, the Department has arranged 414 appointments with debtors, of which 313 have attended. Officers meet with tenants individually and try and establish the reason for the non-payment and offer assistance to the repayment plan. Meetings are amiable. Officials consider individual circumstances and try to assist genuine cases of hardship as much as possible. Close liaison with the Department of Social Security could be verified whether rent relief may be offered, And in cases of unemployment, we have also established a seamless referral system to the employment service, which luckily just happens to be next door to the housing department. At the moment, we have two teams of officers to see people daily, and there are, Mr. Speaker, a further 687 meetings scheduled. So as you can see, Mr. Speaker, a very large total, and people are engaging well. So far, Mr. Speaker, 196 repayment agreements have been signed since January this year. This has secured arrears in the sum of £766,447.99. Payment is mostly secured by deduction of force and standing order. Essentially, so far we have secured the sum of £21,557 a month in respect to the arrears via repayment agreement. And in addition, and I would say more importantly, we have secured the payment of monthly rent going forward in the form of £16,012.14 every month. Of course, that number will continue to increase as the team continues to increase. And we have introduced a mechanism in the software that immediately advises us upon default in the payment of the arrears agreement, and a letter is issued immediately. The department is now working closely with a number of other government departments to update information internally, working together to safeguard areas by public sector workers, and other mechanisms will be introduced for those who work in the private sector. But first and foremost, Mr. Speaker, while the figures that I have quoted are important, the most important thing is that there is a clear strategy on arrears collection which is being pursued by the housing department, is constantly under review with a view to improvement. The debt has been allowed to accumulate over a period of 20 years. It is still early days in our strategy, but it is clearly working in a very short period of time. The strategy has to see those two phases. Of course, we aim to recover the existing debt, but even more importantly, we want to stop it from escalating further. And by introducing the new mechanism, we are securing the monthly rent going forward. That is, we not only have we reduced the figure of the debt, we have now implemented the new system. Had we not implemented the new system, it would have continued to grow beyond £6 million. And Mr. Speaker, I am delighted to report that since the answer to the last Parliament question on the balance of arrears, i.e., people who owe in excess of 3 months' rent as of the 31st of May, the balance of arrears as of the 30th of June has again reduced to £5,425,830.21. Mr. Speaker, the debt accrued is not something that can be easily resolved overnight. After all, it has taken 20 years for it to be released. I am happy to report, Mr. Speaker, that when the GSOC left office in 1996, arrears were £665,031. And it was under the GSOC's watch that rental arrears passed the 1 million mark and increased steadily and by about 600% by the time that they left office, leaving behind a debt of £4 million by 2011, only £4 million. While it is a matter of fact that the debt continued to grow in the same trend while we were unable to change the system at the outset, we are now addressing the matter. And I am relieved that the balance of arrears is for the first time in steady decline. An important factor, Mr. Speaker, and I'm sure that those officers, in particular Mr. Clinton, will be glad to hear, this strategy has been implemented without any additional human resources expense. We have done this by restructuring the department and redeploying people internally. So no additional personnel have been employed and there has been no need and therefore no expense incurred in everything. Mr. Speaker, it is still early days, but the important point to note is that there is a plan of action, the plan is in place, and it is working. The most valuable achievement is ensuring that going forward tenants do not continue to default in their areas. And I am confident, Mr. Speaker, that my report at the end of this financial year will show significant improvement, and I look forward to reporting back to this Parliament a year from now. Mr. Speaker, at this stage, I must publicly recognize the commitment and hard work of the Arrears Recovery Team at the Housing Department for their absolute dedication to the process. Previously, unfortunately, they had no mandate to do this. Despite them wanting to embark on the recovery of arrears as a diligent public servant that they are. This year, they have vigorously pursued the arrears recovery strategy, asking hundreds of people, and not all meetings are pleasant, Mr. Speaker, as you can imagine. They have processed hundreds of payments accurately and on time, and all with a turnover, vigor, and efficiency that you would have thought that they were being paid on commission on the amount recovered. On a final note on housing and a reference to the Ombudsman's report. For the last few years, the Ombudsman has noted a downward trend in housing complaints and inquiries. I am pleased that this trend continues to the extent, according to the Ombudsman, that we could see housing issues being removed from the top of the complaint list. Housing has always been a very difficult sector. But it is indeed very gratifying to read such an acknowledgement, because it's even more gratifying that the logical effect is that we are assisting more people and more people are happy with the thing. Turning to equality, Mr. Speaker, as a government, we have demonstrated a strong track record on equality in our first term, and this will of course continue our work as we strive for a more inclusive community. Mr. Speaker, having introduced the Green Partnership legislation in my state of the office, the most flagrant is present in our manifesto commitment to regard for amendments to the Marriage Act to make it equal for all. As you are aware, in our manifesto, we set ourselves a commitment and a timeline for June. We have already undertaken the consultation process, but given the results of the referendum have been overtaken by events, and we seek the indulgence of the electorate for a little longer. But that does not mean that we have left out of the Council of Ministers. In July last year, the Equal Opportunities Act was amended to include transgender individuals as a class for subsequent discrimination. And we are working with other government departments on progressing policies in this regard of the process. And a lot of work, Mr. Speaker, has been undertaken on the implementation and the re-implementation of the rights of disabled, including the quantum consultation with stakeholders, and we are finalising the document to be able to give this effect. This is not the only progress on the rights of people with disabilities, and we continue to make progress to assist individuals with disabilities and have introduced various important measures throughout the year already. There has also been substantial training both to the private and public sector on accessibility expenses as we prepare for the introduction of regulations to make buildings accessible to housing. Importantly, as part of our work in life planning for the disabled, the Department is spearheading an interagency working group with a view to formulating a strategy for people with autism and assisting as well as other people with other learning disabilities. I also continue to undertake work in gender equality, and this year, numerous awareness events have been arranged while we continue to work on the substantive matters on this front. Mr. Speaker, this is an area where I am greatly assisted by the support of professionals and youth in the volunteer sector, with whom I work very closely, and wish to thank all those who have provided professional and practical guidance. Mr. Speaker, my final portfolio is, of course, social services. The development in this department is ongoing. In the same way, the needs of our community and society change, and the service and skills that it adapts are modelled its services to reflect this. The users of social services encounter in their lives issues which affect many facets and their main things, and the inter-agency teams that work to support them are embraced. I'm happy to report that there now seems to be a deeper understanding that social services does not work in isolation from other government departments. The Social Services Department of the Care Agency provides to children, vulnerable adults, adults with learning disabilities, and individuals suffering from addiction. The driving force in children's services is the understanding that children want to grow up within their families and the opportunity, and want the opportunity to grow up in a safe, healthy family unit, is what social services aspire for every child. It is for this reason that the dynamic of children's services has now changed to promote early intervention and avoid future difficulties such as criminality, substance abuse, and domestic abuse in the rising. One of the flagship successes, which I'm very proud of in the service this year, has been the adoption and fostering service and its development, and as a way of providing a family life for children who cannot live with their own parents. The care agency celebrated its first fostering and adoption awareness week in October 2015. The success of the campaign has been reflected in the number of children placed with foster parents and family placements in the last few months, as opposed to institutional care. This is a great achievement for children. Training of potential foster and adoptive parents has greatly improved, and it helps individuals cope with the sometimes contentious issues of fostering within a small community. The success of the fostering initiative has had an effect on residential services, which is undergoing a restructure, as the team there work closely with the family patients to ensure their success. The process for leaving their children has also been greatly improved, thereby achieving a better result for children who grow up and leave residential service, but for whom there continues to be support in social services where necessary to assist them in a conversion to adulthood and independence. The team from adult services for assist vulnerable adults aged 18 or over principally support individuals to live safely and independently in the community. This is generally achieved through a multidisciplinary approach to social workers, carers, and other agencies. This year, the service received a total of 472 referrals for social work assessment and support. There is an increasing amount of referrals from the public and self-referrals, and this is as a result of the growing confidence in the service. They are also responsible for the running of the day centre for the elderly at Water Authority. Such a valuable investment, Mr. Speaker, for the benefit of our elderly community, were able to spend time in this warm and caring environment. Traumatary care, of course, continues to be provided to assist vulnerable, elderly, or infirm people at home. We constantly monitor the service for clinical standards, as well as to ensure that it runs on a cost-efficient basis. Social workers are now integrated in hospitals, and multidisciplinary teams and bed management meetings, which ensures proper planning of services and a seamless approach to care. At present, we have 220 individuals receiving care at home through social services. This enables elderly people to remain at home safely and independently for longer and in line with their wishes. During this financial year, the focus of the disability service has been the emphasis on continued improvements to ensure the high standards and quality of care are provided at St. Bernadette and structurally wider home. We have engaged the services of an external consultant to assist in the development of the service and assessment of individual services. We have refurbished St. Bernadette to improve it and make it more accessible and completely refurbish the home children, which is so core to our service. And finally, turning to addiction rehabilitation and outreach and community services provided by the care agency. This government, Mr. Speaker, and all of us who are responsible for drug and alcohol abuse treatment in different ways are totally and equally committed to assist those who may suffer from this. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman opposite yesterday mentioned that he has met with addicts in recovery and is learning from what he hears. And Mr. Speaker, that is so important, and that is exactly what I have been doing for over 4 years, and Minister Linares as well, who held it for service last year, because this is how we have shaped our policies and led the service to where it is. And what it is, Mr. Speaker, is a far cry from what it was when we first came in. And I am sure that what I found, Mr. Speaker, in 2011 is not what Mr. Corbyn, who initially took up with the strong left either. I know what we inherited, Mr. Speaker. I was there, I saw it, and entered the lapidated British Commons, forgotten and neglected by the GSE. And I'm not referring to the building, I am referring to the people who needed it at that time. But I do not wish to dwell on the past, Mr. Speaker, because we have to move on and we have to move forward. and that is not what this service is about. In previous answers to questions, Mr. Speaker, I have stated that Oxford to level that this is fine and higher than ever. Well, good point, Mr. Speaker. Last month, I was delighted to be faced with a problem that it was full capacity. This had not happened for at least 12 years, and it shows that the system is now working and help is being provided. Incidentally, Mr. Speaker, on that occasion, I asked the staff to meet me by bankers of the temporary measure, as I wanted to ensure, as I always have, that people who will ask for help and seek to be admitted or even. Beyond this plan, you have important bankruptcy commitments to meet on a wider strategy, and you're working very hard to achieve this. And once our ambitions are implemented, we will inform how drugs are used and its damaging consequences are dealt with in our community. This is certainly an area where inter-agency working together is crucial for success, as is engagement with charities and voluntary systems with whom I meet frequently, and they may have an open door on my system. The significance of the progress of the care agency is the overall improvement over the past few years. This has been achieved principally through the employment of staff in a service which never had a full complement of either professionals or administrative support. And it's also very important to note that the administrative support in the care agency gives the backbone and the essential support to the professionals. Social services as an essential service, has seen great growth of key staff in our first home office, and we are clearly seeing the results of this valuable investment. One of the key functions outside the day-to-day professional work is the outreach career work that is undertaken by staff to encourage specifically people to consider a career in training, whether it be as a social worker, in care, or nursing. We are keen to invest in the future of the service. Finally, Mr. Speaker, I would like to give service to Mr. Albert Hussein, who retired as the CEO of the Care Agency at the end of last year. Albert is a kind man and someone who holds strong principles and values and has dedicated his career to working in the public sector. Albert stepped in as CEO of the Care Agency over 3 years ago at a very difficult time and helped steer the ship and give it balance to pass together. Being at the helm of this incredibly challenging and demanding organization is not an easy task. Nor is it putting up with the most demanding part of it, Mr. Speaker, and that is your school. After a short period of retirement, Albert has agreed to work with me again, but in my ministerial office on a part-time basis. I am grateful that he has, and I look forward to working with him again. His role will now be different, but no less important. This year, I have also seen the retirement of Debbie Grimm, the head of service of the Adult Social Work Team. Debbie is a full professional, a kind and gentle lady who has dedicated her career to helping others and has done a lot for social services in Georgia, and from whom I have learned a lot. I wish her well, but ask that she does not go too far either. It was pleasing to thank everybody who works with me, Mr. Speaker, either on a daily basis or in my department, or the department that I call upon for support from time to time. I have numerous departments that I am responsible for, Mr. Speaker, and I work closely with senior management and officials to progress its service for the benefit of those in our element, so I could not make progress without their support. My portfolio is vast, varied, and very demanding, with very real and life issues, and of late also requires a lot of travel. So, Mr. Speaker, my team, particularly those in my immediate ministerial office, while a very small team, are very hardworking and dedicated and help me keep everything together. They provide me with day-to-day support and also coordinate with all the departments and sectors that I am responsible for. Together, Mr. Speaker, we will all continue to work hard in order to deliver what we have committed to in our manifesto. Thank you.
The Honourable Lord Zeman. Mr. Speaker, I am proud and privileged to be delivering my maiden project today. The past 7 months have been a defining learning curve for me, sitting on this side of the House and he sent me through the invitation. And the speaker, I shall be taking your advice and questions to you and making a short and important statement. I have to start my speech with what I feel is the most important issue defining people of basic human rights in our society. And even though we keep on hearing promises, that is a delay in bringing to this Parliament the Disability Bill, adopting the UN Convention. With the command statement having been issued months before the last year elections, to further delay bringing the bill to Parliament, given to the 2011 manifesto commitment, isn't justifiable. Any continued stalling would only harvest bucket loads of foul ending. It is simply reprehensible for government to drag its feet on this one and reply with their rhetorical answers. Yes, it is easy to blame a previous government for delays, but we're not here to question previous administration. We are here to progress by working with and scrutinizing the administration of the day. I do not have to shoulder the blame of past administration, in the same way as you are not reminded of the historical issues. The UN Convention was published in 2006, and the person on the street does not care who does what and when. What the person out there wants to hear is why is it taking 10 years for Parliament to bring this legislation back? I must say that when it finally makes its way through these doors, I expect it not to be the watered-down version published in the command paper. And instead, it takes on board the hard work done in preparing the disability bill between 2006 and 2011, which government wants to pretend never existed, even though all stakeholders have said. I understand that representations have been made to government by stakeholders with their concerns and advice, and I truly hope government listens and adopts the UN Convention in its full version. On the other hand, I am able and pleased to congratulate government on its achievements in making public areas such as playgrounds inclusive for those with disabilities. It is gratifying to see playgrounds where children of all capabilities are having fun. I hope to see more of this in the future. And I welcome the estimate item to finally include a list in Parliament's House. I know the particular person who will be making continuous use of that list. Returning to another area of criticism is a delay in providing a family centre, which was an issue of concern for this administration during their term in opposition, which has fallen down the wayside with one parliamentary term having already elapsed, and yet not seen the opening of the centre. Another important area which is proving difficult to address is a situation which I believe exists in the care agency, but is almost impossible to scrutinise. And that is the influx of subcontracted workers. I have, however, been able to identify that 48 subcontracted workers were working under the disabilities umbrella as of February 2016, out of a potential complement of 95. Astounding though it is, this means that more than half of their personnel is subcontracted. I make this point on the basis of the limited information I have and is publicly available. And in the hope that the members' offices can prove me wrong during this parliamentary session. This would make a welcome departure from the smoke screens and diversions to which we have become accustomed from the other side of this house and this session. These workers receive basic training and are entrusted with tendering the needs of the most vulnerable members in our society. It now conspires that there is no independent regulator and that government regulates the contracted parties. This is wrong in any sector. But when we are talking about the most vulnerable people in our community, it is completely and utterly intolerable and shocks me to the core. Government should not play a security part in this centre at all. There should be a robust body, such as the FTC in a school system, as the GRA in a school system, and as is the Environmental Agency in a school system, that can professionally and independently review this sector without fear or favour. We understand that annual leave, maternity leave, and sick leave may give rise to a need to seek assistance from the recruitment agencies in order to keep the services running. However, this should not be in lieu of employing and failing long-term staff. Furthermore, there is a bigger issue than just long-term employment for workers, but also the long-term continuity for the service users. There are services we cannot tolerate sudden short-term changes, and these should be avoided at all costs, and covered should be sourced from the existing team of staff and not externally. This also gives rise to slow-developing workers, who are not trained as able, but rather become stagnant and motivated. As a result, the sector is run on a continuous firefighting mode, instead of having a robust human resources policy and management, which not only guarantees continuity of service, but also factors in long-term training requirements. I strongly believe a care policy commission is pivotal to the success of the care industry, the elderly care services, the juvenile chambers, and the weekend. It monitors and assesses the quality of the care being delivered and rates it accordingly. It does so with full independence and freedom. This, coupled with an individual carer support plan and supportive carer policy, will truly take the border to a different level, in line with other modern forward-thinking societies around the world. Stay-home unpaid carers should be recognized by government in as many ways as possible, from enhanced employment conditions, respite, financial benefits, training, and advice. Some of these may be available to certain carriers who have sympathetic employers, but it is important to provide an accessible legislative framework in this area so that it is open to scrutiny, clear and available to all recognised caregivers. We should be working together on cross-party policies that are for the benefit of those elected beyond elections, beyond administration, and beyond party politics. On a more positive note, I am pleased to see an item in the estimate for Project Search. I'm surprised it has not been mentioned in this budget session, even though it is in the budget report. We strongly believe this is to be an improvement on the current supported employment scheme, given its private sector structure in the UK. It will enable young adults to grow within a framework, whilst at the same time supporting employers in each individual placement. It's all about creating awareness and destigmatizing the employment of individuals with learning and or physical disabilities in the private sector. I look forward to seeing the progress made by this initiative in the upcoming months and trust that those currently employed under the SIP scheme will be transferred onto Project Search so they may also benefit from this initiative. It has also been encouraging to see and welcome the awareness campaign in fostering and adoption. This initiative must be maintained and expanded in order to see the results we all want to see and apparently see. As well as the evident usage of fertility clinics, as you will ask the question and answer session, IVF services formally introduced by this administration for those unable to naturally conceive is proving successful. Moving on to the administrative aspects of the healthcare, the primary care centre, we understand and accept, is a work in progress. No administration has got it 100% right. However, it is important for government to listen to both complaints made directly to them and from the opposition benches. The system is leading to many cases less than attended for days and weeks, long waiting times on the phone, and complicated systems which are elderly in particular find difficult to comprehend. This inevitably has a knock-on effect on the overuse of the A&E department and causes unnecessary delay there. We also see a huge amount of council operations. We have no reason to doubt the Honourable Minister for Health when he suggested the majority of cases are not due to the GHA's inability to perform the surgery. But the fact remains that the number of cancer operations due to bed shortages is staggering. I hope that these will diminish with the eventual opening of the long overdue dementia residential facility. Whilst it is opened, it will inevitably not be enough. We are living longer, and the older generations need to have infrastructure and policies to cater for their needs. One example which we need to materialise is the accessibility of older people in private accommodations who are unable to access other resources and the upcoming houses. I hope government initiates in this area in a user subsidised residential accommodation where this demographic can enjoy their independence, albeit in a suitable infrastructure. I have to congratulate the government on the MS Nurse initiative. which I understand is providing the support and accessibility MS sectors such as so needed. Additionally, we fully support and congratulate the government on the organ transplant program, which this government has initiated and enacted on a senior resident successful case. We also look forward to the oncology centre being in operation and hope it provides treatment to as many sufferers as possible so they can avoid the added inconvenience of travelling outside the course of the season. Moving on to tourism, which I feel is an important area for Gibraltar, regardless of which political parties and governments, and where we should therefore try and develop ideas and steer away from partisan politics as much as possible. The government prides itself on the upward trend, but this is following a sharp shock during the first term in office. The government has spent $4.27 million on tourism marketing over the last 3 years. One would expect to see tangible results as a result of this level of investment in the tourism sector. I will accept and congratulate the staff involved in the increase of air passengers and reiterate the fact that the new terminal has allowed for air connectivity for the expansion which could simply not have been possible from the old terminal, let alone parking the planes in the old layout. However, what the goal is trying out for are more connections to cities in mainland Europe. I hope this will become a priority for those involved and wish them all the best in achieving the user pricing results. Improved passenger figures are now suspected of work carried out in order to restore the levels of passengers that were enjoyed during the ROC during the GST's golden age period in office. I would now urge those concerned to motivate cruise liners to stay for longer. Looking through the statistics, there are many cruise liners who only spend a few hours in the port, meaning that passengers have limited leisure and retail time. In many cases, because of their early arrivals in the early hours of the morning, the time available to them is in Gibraltar does not even coincide with the opening hours of the Upper Mate Reserve. So, as well as citing potential tourist expenditure, the full Gibraltar period is minimal. In terms of manned quota figures, there is a drop of 15% between 2011 and 2015. This drop is sufficient to stifle the overall figure of tourists entering the data. This downward trend is also the case for tourist expenditures, where we are seeing a 29% drop from 2011 to 2015. If the levels of tourist expenditure seen in 2010 and 2011 have been maintained, this would translate into a tourist expenditure loss of £300 million over the last 4 years. And all this, Mr. Speaker, was spending unprecedented levels of investment in marketing. These figures are important, Mr. Speaker, they cannot be ignored. This trend affects traders and businesses in our city, which is why I have made the point in the past the tourist sector is a pillar of our economy, one which can grow in a sustainable manner, but not to be meddled with irresponsibly. One that must be handled with care. We can throw all the money we want at marketing, but if we don't have the root and branch plan, organisation and infrastructure, the tourist experience is sour and the long-term vision is impeded. For example, Mr. Speaker, we have always been saying from our first press release, following the foreign vehicle ban to the Upper Rock, that we agree with this measure. We were providing ways in which this policy could be implemented in the best way possible for all concerned, with the tourist experience at heart. Additionally, we were urging government to extend to those with disabilities from the ban. The latter is claimed to have been taken on board, even though there is nothing on the Visit Gibraltar website to indicate that this is the case. And I quote from the website, "No unauthorized private vehicles are permitted in the nature of it. However, a number of walking, taxi and bus tours are available. On this basis, Mr. Speaker, unless you're an organized trip, you're unable to visit Lafayette, and clarification needs to be provided. Of course, this will impact negatively on the level of revenue to government from the Upper Rock site entrance fees, as well as the infrastructure and the tourist experience. Yes, we have seen unprecedented levels of investment in the Upper Rock, £1.8 million investment on flashy gimmicks between the suspension bridge and Mount Midway lookout, which at a personal level I like, As I'm an adrenaline junkie, I really, really like them. However, we are still seeing filthy water habitats from the cat. An inadequate priority and foresight to improve the basic health and safety for tourists, introducing balustrades. The virus were encouraging tourists to walk around the upper rocks. This is an accident waiting to happen. Europa Point is another tourist hotspot. It is visited by millions of tourists every year. It is an ideal location overlooking the majestic spaces of Volta. Yes, the old shop that was demolished has been left there as an eyesore. The simple provisional landscaping of the site could have at least brought the land in line with the rest of the area. Not to mention the space to which the popular playground based by the GST government has been allowed to deteriorate. What is the point, Mr. Speaker, in permitting the destruction of the popular area which is enjoyed by so many people carriers? Justice for two places point. Surely the community comes first, or do the members of it care only about both at the lesson time? Moving on to another of my assigned portfolios, reports. The Gibraltar Port Recurrent Revenue is coming in at staggering downward figures. The tariff fees once enjoyed by Gibraltar of 4.3 million at a peak in 2012-13 had disintegrated into 2.6 million estimated for 2016-17. If the upgoing trend up until 2012-13 had at least been levelled and maintained, government would have had an extra £4 million pounds more over the last 3 years, and £6 million by the time we are at this time in school. Where is this money going to? Unable to set a base. In the latest scale, the same can be said for the bunkering revenue. From nearly breaking the £1 million mark in 2010-11, the forecast for 2016-17 is a measly £400,000 in comparison. It is safe to say that approximately £1 million of revenue has been lost, probably due to migration of business across the field, meaning local businesses are also losing out in these trades. This is a worrying downward trend, and I generally hope to see an upward trend in both areas. But still, Mr. Speaker, we have a beautiful small boat marina, coming in at £24 million. 700 lucky owners have been gifted there to the tune of £34,000 each, in exchange for which they are liable to pay service charges to a sinking fund for the maintenance of the same. If this is not a clear example of the culture of entitlement we have so often spoken about, I don't know what is. The cost of each bed, which has been gifted to each user, is roughly the equivalent of the 50-50 mortgages which the new homeowners have had to obtain under the recent affordable housing scheme. It simply doesn't make sense. It's not all bad though. It's brought back recreational fishing as we used to enjoy in the North Mole. And I'm happy for those who have obtained the berth this event. I hope government will punish the successful applicants so that the electorate can see that it has been a fair process. As a standalone project, it clearly has its merits. In the context of prudent management of our economy, particularly with the threat of an EU referendum looming over us at the time, I am convinced that there are much more meritorious projects which could have been prioritized, such as the dementia facility, St. Martin School, and all other schools for that matter. I must say, we welcome the New York Registry being prepared. It will see the requirements for vessel insurance among other important prerequisites. Together with welcoming the fast launch act amendment, I highlighted both issues recently in a viewpoint program where I stated that these methods should have coincided with the opening of the Midtown Marina before owners began to purchase their vessels. Having said that, I must say we were actually told about the amendment in the fast launch act by a seller I proposed to already knew that this was coming into force before it was even published. Moving swiftly on to animal welfare issues. No, it's not insulting, is it? People volunteering for anything. Moving swiftly on to animal welfare issues. It is a sad note to note that this government's abysmal failure in respect of investing in job cuts. The £25,000 investment out of an earmarked £50,000 last year at the Alameda Garden has seen an attempt to convert a footpath into a park. But unfortunately, it is still a long way away. As highlighted back in January, the surface needs rethinking, as well as the basic fencing and gating of the area. unfortunately, I can only say it looks like a waste of money from where I'm sitting. Looking from this perspective, it looks like no further investment will be directed that way in the current financial year, leaving the gloomy area as it is and the plan shown to the public as a minority. Something which could inevitably not go down well with job owners in Gibraltar, especially in light of a 500% increase in job licenses and 250% hike in job registration as from November. Clearly, you're better off owning a boat than a job. I understand that the increase in licenses is to subsidize the DNA testing to match job challenges, a measure which I fully support. However, it is sad to see that this measure, which has been limited from the island of Capri, will not be met with the equivalent fine for offenders of €2,000 as exists in Capri. The money from irresponsible owners should be subsidized on the center and not just the responsible owners. I hope to be given the opportunity to work with government on issues of concern and adequate management of and care of feral cats, street cats, breeding and sale of pets, welfare neglect, and all other areas in which we are underdeveloped and need organizing. Finally, Mr. Speaker, I wish to thank you, the class and his staff, and for your help and support you have all provided me in the short time as a member of this House. I would like to end by reminding the House that I come in good faith to hold the government to account, as well as to ensure that its policies and commitments are fulfilled effectively and justly. I congratulate them when you do so. Thank you.
The Honourable Stephen Lamar. Mr. Speaker, it is my honour and privilege to deliver, as Minister for Sport, Culture, Heritage, Youth and Civic Rights, my fifth budget speech to this House. The civic rights aspects of my portfolio are two main areas. The first is that of the Office of the Ombudsman and team, to provide guidance and support when required. The second is the Citizen Advance Bureau, which is known as CAB for short. Both these offices run as independent entities. However, they are funded by a taxpayer, therefore it is my duty to monitor their expenditure and the role, and for this reason I am accountable to this House. This has been the procedure since the two organizations were established. Since mediation was introduced in Gibraltar in 2010, UK Mediation has partnered with CAB to develop and grow mediation services locally. Four staff members from the Gibraltar Bureau are now accredited and trained mediators after obtaining mediation practitioner certificate, which is accredited by a number of UK institutions. This certificate equips them to resolve disputes and complaints involving employment, customer, neighbourhood and family issues. CAB is running a Here to Help website. This website is being used to spread the word through social media networks and showcase volunteers and community needs. They have inspired charities to work together and advise how people can volunteer for their respective organizations. This gives members of the public an opportunity to find out what roles are on offer, to allow them to take part in events and to take inspiration to help communities through volunteering. The website address is heretohelp.gr. CAB has also initiated a money advice clinic as part of the services that it offers. It has increased client contacts this year. The aim of this clinic is to help clients establish their financial situation, so that they can safeguard their homes and their belongings, have sufficient money to feed and clothe their families, and pay their debts at affordable rates. Mr. Speaker, the money advice process is a systematic way of working with clients to achieve this aim. CAB works in partnership with utility companies and community care offices with a financial or banking background to assist clients in this process as part of their community care duties. CAB staff have been engaged in giving presentations and talks under the Save Face Waste Advice campaign. This covers energy saving advice and other safety information. The campaign targets senior citizens who feel more comfortable in their homes, in those in elderly accommodation or elsewhere. However, this comfort can also reduce awareness of hazards that could lead to injury. Accurate information, advice, and planning are essential to their well-being. The Bureau were joined by the essential services in this campaign. Together, they issued well-sized cards with useful numbers to senior citizens for them to call in the event of an emergency. Mr. Speaker, I now move on to the Office of the Ombudsman. In the past year, the Ombudsman's Office has been given responsibility to handle GHA complaints. The Office now also deals with ADR and reports on the complaints against government departments and related bodies. Mr. Speaker, the Ombudsman assumed responsibility for health-related complaints from 2015. This was in accordance to our 2011 manifesto. Government provided funds with two extra members of staff. The office started at the Invernham Hospital to provide an in-situ service to deal with complaints, and inquiries were also provided. This new task has proved to be quite challenging with a very steep learning curve. The aim of the Ombudsman team is to meet the expectations of the service users while never forgetting the GHA staff themselves. It is important to point out that the vast majority of instances the staff provide an excellent service and standard of care. Now I take this opportunity to congratulate the Ombudsman and his team for the professional manner in which they have handled complaints against the GHA. Mr. Speaker, in June 2015, the Consumer Alternative Dispute Resolution Regulation 2015 came into force. The Public Service Ombudsman was named as the competent and reporting authority for Gibraltar. The responsibility of the Ombudsman grew as a result of this, and the office attracted an increased workload. Government has made available an extra officer to be redeployed to assist the Ombudsman with this task. ADR is a means by which a customer may wish to resolve a dispute with a trader or service provider. These provisions are aimed at consumers and have no effect in disputes between traders. Ever since the Ombudsman first became operational in Gibraltar, this office has always aimed to deliver the best possible service to those who seek their assistance. To this effect, members of staff as well as the Ombudsman continue to travel abroad to learn about the service which is provided elsewhere. The Ombudsman regularly attends Ombudsman's meetings, conferences, and seminars. The office in Gibraltar belongs to different organizations, and this context is used in order to keep abreast of the development in the Ombudsman's world. Their basic aim is to consistently make their office a beacon of not only good administration, but also of excellence in the delivery of service to the people of Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, as a result of this meeting, the Ombudsman have recently introduced a system improvement officer. It's called the CEO. He has designated the number of his staff to undertake the responsibility of CEO, which will include, amongst other things, to ensure that the Ombudsman's recommendations have been put into effect and acted. Other aspects of this role will include undertaking a review of their own internal working methods and procedures. The Ombudsman is always conscious that they owe a duty of service to those who seek their assistance and is therefore keen to ensure that their service delivery is on target or whether it needs improving. Mr. Speaker, I'll move on now onto the youth service. To speak of the past year, the youth service has undergone a number of significant changes, most notably within its structure and staffing arrangement. This has led to an increase in face-to-face work with more young people. We are all reaching out to other government departments, agencies and NGOs. The Youth Service is working with them by advocating an improvement and better services for young people in our community. The administration of the Gibraltar Youth Service continues to be based at the main offices of the Ministry of Culture, where the staff continue to provide support for youth service. The professional complement of the youth service consists of the principal youth officer, two senior youth workers, and five youth and community workers. In September 2015, all youth service staff members completed a consultation with United Union and the Human Resources Department and government legal offices. In November 2015, as a result of the consultation, the Gibraltar Youth Service produced a set of policies and procedures called Delivering Youth Work in Gibraltar. These sets of policies and procedures have now been adopted, and all members of staff who work with in the youth work team. Mr. Speaker, the youth work team is a complemented by supplies, by youth support workers who provide backing to full-time youth and community teams. The youth service has worked very closely with human resources in regularizing the employment status of all employees. The service has continued to work closely with the human resources and Unite to ensure that we support our employees by putting measures and systems in place. These measures and systems have ensured that we continue to maintain and raise the standard of our youth and community work team and as we aim for best practice. Mr. Speaker, in addition to supporting the work carried out by the youth clubs and youth projects, we have once again offered the locally recognized and assessed course in understanding youth work to volunteers and prospective youth support workers. This year, trainees were given the choice between the assessed or non-assessed group. The non-assessed group offered the trainees a certificate of attendance along with the chance to volunteer their services to various youth work projects. Due to the success of their training, plans are now well in advance to offer understanding youth work training to anyone interested in working with youth and young people from October 2016. Mr. Speaker, the Youth Service is committed to professional development and it constantly continues to update and skills audit for all its employees. All full-time employees and some youth support workers have undergone training in the following areas: safeguarding children, tier 1, health and safety, first aid at work, basic fire and rescue training. In addition, two youth support workers have recently completed food hygiene courses. The Youth Service is a member of the Child Protection Committee. And following a request by the care agency in November 2015, the Youth Service agreed to join the Safeguarding Children and Young People training team as from January 2016. In January 2016, all Youth Service staff underwent a very successful and inspired weekend of professional development training organized by the Youth Service itself. It was delivered by Moira Smith and Leslie Buckland, who are renowned academics from the YMCA George Williams College. The government, Speaker, has invested in people and in facilities. During the past year, both Delphine and Plato Youth Club have undergone significant refurbishment. In addition to their current facilities, these now have new modern and up-to-date kitchens for young people to use and learn necessary life skills. On Thursday, the 17th of September 2015, the Youth Service and the Royal Gibraltar Police signed a memorandum of understanding to consolidate the areas of joint work teams with both organizations with both organizations carry out. This has allowed the two organizations to build a professional relationship of trust to address any issue that young people may have in the actual youth club or also in the wider community. The Youth Advisory Council has been expanding. The Duke of Edinburgh Award, the guides and scouts have provided advice to government about issues that affect young people. In order to improve the service for young people, we have included representatives in the council from the RDP, the Department of Education, the GHA, the Care Agency, and also the Drug Coordinator. As Minister for Youth, I felt it important to give young people a voice in our community. The Youth Service set up a youth forum, and a number of meetings were arranged, which included members of this forum, where these young people raised any issue that they wanted. As a result of these meetings, young people have had the opportunity to meet with my colleague, Minister Sacramento, and I at the Youth Centre, and to discuss a number of matters. This went very well. Mr. Speaker, the Youth Service are working closely with young people and advocating on their behalf so that the issues raised by them are taken seriously and acted upon. Members of the Youth Forum also met the GHA General Manager, Mr. Darian Figueredo, and with the Director of Education, Joey Rito. This forum will continue to expand. There will be more meetings arranged in order to give our young people the opportunity to raise issues that concern them. Mr. Speaker, the Youth Service has a well-established working relationship with the Department of Education. They have worked very effectively together with Bayside and Westside Schools and with the College of Further Education. In order to reach out to more young people, the senior team held a meeting with the Director of Education recently. They agreed that the Youth Service would start work with the school year 7 pupils from all middle schools. The initiative has been expanded to private schools with a view to offer the service for the of the department and to reach out to as many young people as possible in our community. The Speaker, the Youth Service has been involved in organizing many events for young people. These events have included residential, assembly, outdoor pursuit trips, fundraising, projects such as the healthy lifestyle, environmental awareness, and performing and production. The aim is to make our young people conscious of their rights and responsibilities, and they are important party to the society that they belong to. Mr. Speaker, the Youth Service is an extremely busy department, which has been leading on and successfully achieving many projects thanks to the very committed workforce. With a new youth and community workers in post, and as the team continues to develop their profession, they hope to continue their success. The government looks forward at an even busier and promising year ahead, where the needs of the young people will always be at the top of the agenda. I would like to take this opportunity to thank the staff and the management and staff of the Youth Service. I would also like to thank the Loop Foundation, which helps out the Youth Service in helping them fund many projects that they deliver. Mr. Speaker, I move on now on to the heritage matter. Throughout this busy year, we have been consolidating existing work in anticipation for future projects. The department has committed itself to securing and following through a number of important projects. The museum-led World Heritage Gift for the Golden Strait and the surrounding areas is progressing well. The Djibouti Museum team has been working tirelessly to finalize our bid, its content and its public outreach components. To this end, the whole new wing of the museum was recently inaugurated on International Museum Day. This new wing exhibits groundbreaking Neanderthal models, state-of-the-art interpretation panels, and previously unseen items from over 20 years of research at Gorham Cave. This year, the museum open day was a resounding success, with over 1,700 visitors, which is a new record. on the ground itself, access to and protection of the cave has been guaranteed through the construction of new walkways. A partial approximation of the Neanderthal environment has been reconstructed with the successful introduction of tamarisk plants. This will be extended in the coming years. It is a tribute to the museum team, led by Professor Sky Finnison and Dr. Jerry Finnison, that they have been able, almost single-handedly, to bring together the necessary expertise, drive, and knowledge into this project, this world-class bid. Whatever happens, there can be no doubt that this is a world-class site of outstanding universal value. Professor Gabriel Cooney, the World Heritage Site Evaluator on behalf of ECOMOS, was suitably impressed by the exceptional progress of the site. As part of the ongoing 5-year management plan supporting the bid, they produced a film called Making the Neanderthals Model. The film will assist to give publicity to the growing diverse and Neanderthal experience. This has been aided by the new cutting-edge documentaries by BBC and BBC, a broad new website, as well as ongoing research at the Tate Complex. Although the final result of our bid will only be known within a few days, our commitment to exhibiting and enhancing our Neanderthal past will endure. Mr. Speaker, the Ministry for Heritage has continued to refurbish the City Hall following the opening of our National Art Gallery. I can now inform the House that a lift has been installed and that the plans are afoot to consolidate the facade of the building as well as refurbishment of the Mayor's Palace. In subsequent years, it will be able to count on an even bigger and better National Gallery and a sitting hall for our mayors and their functions. This will include the housing of all government collections of artwork and the development of the third floor once Chief Telecom moves onto its new premises. As we said in our 2011 manifesto, the City Hall will be a cultural building. Mr. Speaker, a monument to the Gibraltar fallen from both world wars was recently erected at the National Observatory in the UK, carved out of our own limestone. Conceived by Mr. Joe Brugada and designed by Mr. Anselmo Torres, the monument stands as a fitting tribute to those Gibraltarians who gave their lives in these conflicts. As a dozen witnesses of these past conflicts say, their names will live forevermore. They fought against oppression in the past for a better future. Mr. Speaker, in this year's estimate, we have provided funds for the monument to the women in Gibraltar. This has been a project that has gone out of public participation, that has gone out to public participation, and formed in a form of a competition, and which will be commissioned in the next few months. The monument will also fulfil another manifesto commitment. The government is looking to finalise the Gibraltar Heritage and Antiquities Act. I am happy to report that this legislation is now near completion. The public consultation period is over and we have received many insightful comments. These have been looked at, often amending the bill as it stood. The process has considerably improved the end product. I would like to thank all those who sent their views and visions concerning our heritage. The final bill will be a combination of many ideas. The role of the government has been to temper hope with reality, conservation with mitigation. As I said last year, and I reiterate on this occasion, this bill will set an important benchmark, bringing Gibraltar firmly into the 21st century insofar as heritage and best practice is concerned. Aside from greatly deepening our heritage protection, we will have in place comprehensive and acting listed building legislation protecting protection of monuments, and a legislative framework for developer funding archaeological and heritage recording. Mr. Speaker, through the efforts of the Heritage Department working closely with the Government Planning Department, much of the proposed legislation has already become commonplace guidance for day-to-day running and recording of our heritage. In this, the private sector has also been instrumental. Where we have led, they have followed, and I can honestly say that the future prospects for the protection of our heritage is better now than at any point in the last 20 years. During 2015 and 16, we have worked together with developers to combine development with conservation. The results could not be clearer. From the restoration of previous neglected World War II structures, the undertaking and standardization of archaeological working briefs, and the increasing frequency of historical death-based assessments mean that we are recording our past in an unprecedented rate. I hasten to add that this is being done without restricting the building developments that the Gibraltar demands and needs. In the last year, we have shown that heritage protection does not hamper development. Indeed, it enhances it by helping to preserve the past in our construction of the Gibraltar future. Needless to say, this would not have been possible without the unceasing support of the Gibraltar Heritage Trust, who have advised, demonstrated, and broadly agreed with our views. Their vision and impartiality is much appreciated. As for the future, we have an exciting year ahead of us, which we see the completion of the Wellington Farms refurbishment and numerous other projects. For instance, we are looking into the management plan to restore our walls to their ancient standards. We aim to start small, but envisage a 3-year plan where, working closely with the Department of the Environment, we can start removing plants and tidying up our city hall walls. This will complement and work closely in tandem with the government's urban regeneration program, which aims to consolidate and enhance our old town project. Mr. Speaker, in collaboration with the Gibraltar National Archives, we have started a project entitled Mapping Our Past, whereby all the old maps of Gibraltar will be scanned and placed online for all to be able to access. Not only this aids developers in their own plans, but it will be of great service to all those interested in the development of the city of Gibraltar. The first teaser for the potential of the Mapping Our Past project has been now being developed, and it should be online shortly. Mapping Our Past will also serve as a keystone project product that will enable us to pursue the setting up of a historical environmental record. An historical environmental record is the cornerstone of any heritage department. It aims to provide as complete as possible a catalogue of all heritage assets in a given place. We are currently studying the feasibility of undertaking this together with other government departments. Mr. Speaker, our collaboration with the University of Cambridge on the study of the human remains from the S. St. Bernard Hospital continues for another year. Our research in 2015 has shown that the cemetery located here dates not to the 16th through to the 18th century as it was originally assumed. It actually dates to the mid 15th century, in itself significant at the time when the Moorish occupation of the Gibraltar ceased. In effect, we might well be looking at the last Islamic or the first Christian cemetery on the rock. Well preserved human remains from this period are rare and beyond the University of Cambridge this discovery has already interested scholars from Germany, Spain, and the United States of America. Mr. Speaker, we expect greater things from these collaborations, and it serves to understand the international research potential of Gibraltar holds. We may be small, but our vibrant history, and especially its study, enthralls experts everywhere. Mr. Speaker, on the cultural front, no one can deny how in the past 5 years since we came into office, events, facilities, and cultural development have moved forward in leaps and bounds. We have been able to export our culture as well as expose our cultural identity with high-quality exhibits and events. We hosted in Gibraltar the Little Constellation Project, Voices of Asylum. The final exhibition brought 14 international artists to exhibit in Gibraltar. The Voices of Asylum book is about the project held in Gibraltar and has been launched in London and Milan. We participated in the Tourism and Culture Expo in Tangier to promote cultural links with Morocco. The Gibraltar Cultural Services have been instrumental in producing and organizing a retrospective exhibition with Royal Academians Anne Desmet and Christopher and Barbara Ray. This is part of our ongoing cultural development initiative. It is the first time that any Royal Academians have exhibited in Gibraltar. We have supported the participation of local artists in competitions abroad, such as the Royal Academy Summer Exhibition, and backed a Gibraltarian artist during a residency with the Island Games in Jersey in 2015. Further, we are currently in the process of organizing the Gibraltar Berlin Art Residential, which will start this month. This will see a Gibraltarian artist take up a residency in Berlin and a Berlin artist doing a residency in Gibraltar. As we promised in the 2011 manifesto, we opened the Mario Phoenician Art National Art Gallery in June 2015, and the Gibraltar Exhibition of Modern Art Gallery, GEMA, in November 2015, giving Gibraltar its first two permanent art galleries, national art galleries. A total of 34 artworks have been purchased during the current year. The annual GEMA Festival, held in March 2015, was the biggest to date, with 14 entries and over a 4 week of theatre. Support was given to the GMBO to organise the European Showdown Championships in October as part of our event-led tourism initiative. Over 700 dancers participated, and the show was seen by over 1 million viewers online via website and live stream throughout the 4 days of competition. The Gibraltar Cultural Services, who run many of our cultural events together and at times on behalf of the Ministry of Culture, are not only involved in organizing and or monitoring events, they are also involved in managing all the facilities in which these events take place. We have seen the vast improvement at the John Magnus Hall, work to the courtyard to extend the cafeteria, and installation of new gathering systems have been completed. This continued with all appliances for the cafeteria. Repairs were made to the external walls and ceilings of the private high school area. The entire John Magnus Hall theatre roof, which was not maintained for years, has been replaced. The theatre now boasts a new technical upgrade with PA systems and lighting equipment. The refurbishment of the theatre with new flooring and seats is currently taking place and should be completed by the end of summer. The library at the Magnus Hall has seen 400 new books added to the collection. The library catalogue is now digital and can be accessed online. This went live on the 3rd of March 2016. Book titles, authors, and subjects can be searched remotely. Members can also reserve books and extend lending periods online. Additional funds for the children's section had also been purchased. The Central Hall and the Retreat Centre have also seen much needed before this is carried out. GCS is also taking responsibility for maintaining many premises held by cultural, sporting, charitable and associations and clubs. This never used to happen with the previous administration. In fact, what we had when we came into government in 2011 was a claim from a tenant for damages caused by water penetration for windows and roofs. This made us survey all the premises owned by the government. During the last 5 years, many of these premises have now been upgraded, and therefore this should now avoid any future claims. Mr. Speaker, I would like to thank the staff of GCS, especially Mrs. Angela Bula, who is very proactive in maintaining the Massey Store, Central Hall, and all the other venues I have mentioned. Mr. Speaker, after hearing the Honourable Member, Mr. Clinton, reference the DNS, it is disappointing to hear from him that the DOC opposition will not be attending the invitation or will not be accepting the invitation of the government as organizers to attend the music festival this year. He will nonetheless, and all the others will nonetheless receive that invitation, as will all members of the House. We encourage them to attend, as they have every other year. Indeed, I am surprised that he is so entirely calling into question the judgment of his colleagues who have previously attended. You see, Mr. Speaker, it is completely wrong to think that attending a music festival is a jolly of any sort for us on this side of the House. Perhaps you could ask Mr. Peacom, Mr. Hammond, Mr. Hayes, Mr. Rafino, to remember a few of the members of the opposition who accepted the invitation and attended. For ministers, the music festival gives us, the government, more work to do, to spend the time there dealing with problems which are, you might laugh, but it is true, and if you want, you can come to the after festival and follow me all day and 24 hours and 48 hours that I'm organizing. Follow me, and you will realize, and then you will laugh. I spend days and a couple of days organizing and not have a grand time. The other ministers spend their time attending to those who are attending from outside Gibraltar, in particular the gaming and financial services companies that bring their international boards and to Gibraltar for the weekend, and which want to have their many issues dealt with and resolved on the day. This actually happens. It's called networking, problem solving, and engaging with the people who bring business to Gibraltar. We also spend considerable time with MPs and MEPs, meeting them on all aspects of the Gibraltar issue and building relationships. The DMS is many positive things for many people, Mr. Speaker, but for the ministers, it is hard work. He can ask those of his colleagues who have been there with us. It is also true that the opposition is none of these things. They can and enjoy themselves, and they don't solve problems for the festival, and they don't solve problems for the gaming and financial services company board, and they don't meet international boards of these companies either. For the opposition, Mr. Speaker, it is really a jolly. It is really not work for them at all. Mr. Speaker, it would certainly be right to say that attending to the DMS is a jolly for the opposition. It is, in fact, one of the examples of the way that they stick the nose in the box. I have been so in the executive agency Miss Serafina used to describe the cocktail parties to which they always were so keen to be invited. And in addition, Mr. Speaker, I have to tell him that the approach of innovation he has shown suggests that under the DSG government, in which he would be the Minister for Public Finance, there would be no music festival. There would be no music festival. What a pity, because it is not a festival which costs 2.25 million. Yes, as he suggested. Or, no, I give him the explanation. It is one of those that also produces much more than amounts that almost for the whole of the data. Let us look at the wider picture, which Mr. Clinton's myopic view does not reveal. Because the honourable member, Mr. Clinton, is a classic case of knowing what the cost of things is, but not the value. And I was told that by the previous chief minister when I used to criticize the theatre royal. The only thing is that there was no cost, there was loads of cost, and no value to be spent. First of all, the worldwide exposure that the festival brings is almost incalculable. Yeah? Okay? I'll give you the phone call, mate. We appear in massive numbers of media, and the name and the image of the data goes further and wider as a result of GMS. And some other festivals we establish and support. Some we can afford to pay for in advertising terms. Surely he recognizes that at least just that benefit is probably worth close to millions in advertising. I will give you an example later. From data obtained from the GMS, you can see that many businesses in our economy benefited massively from the event. The attendance was 14,000 last year. Indeed, last year was our first of the 2-day festival. We carried 65 apps on 4 pages. Online survey data indicates that all Gibraltar hotels were sold out for 2 days. That is unusual, and of course, hugely important. That is not a week when we usually fill up the hotel. All flights were sold over the weekend. Again, not something that has happened before. From ticket sales, we can see that 85% attended the 2 days. 95% rated the event as very good and excellent. As a result, let's see what the music festival does for the voter. Mm-hmm. 4,500 tickets were sold overseas. So that means that we received at least that number of visitors in Gibraltar for the event. And that doesn't include the people from outside who have tickets purchased for them by those inside Gibraltar, like the members of the board of the directors of gaming companies, which I referred to before. And who hold the international board meetings in Gibraltar for those weekends. That is a huge bonus in numbers of people visiting and spending in Gibraltar. According to UK music reports in 2013, the overseas music tourists spend an average of £750 per event, with their telecommunication, food and drink, merchandise and other costs thrown in. This means that in the GMS weekend, people from overseas spent approximately £3.4 million. Although this is obviously not direct income to the government. Spending inside the GMS facilities has also been analyzed, and a very honorable member see the benefits of this information I have been provided by the organizers. The commentary industry benefits to the tune of £154,000, local charities and clubs, £32,000. In addition, of course, the Culture House had an additional £23,275 right, from the government donation of the amount left over from the birthday, bringing associates £255,000 of benefits to charities. Arts and crafts and merchandise, £26,000. 1,000 people were employed on the 2 days of the GMS and benefited and also enjoyed the event. This is what is spending on these events means to the whole of the economy. The events like tourism work, and we get more and more data. As we get more and more data, we can see that this policy is beneficial. We work closely with the tourist board to make events, to market events abroad. And that's the benefit is that people from overseas attend the event, and most of the time come to the Bosan on other occasions. That's an addition, Mr. Speaker. The fact is that even more directly, we will see how we directly recover the 2.25 million. You see, Mr. Speaker, we do things in a business plan, and our business plan sets out how we are going not just to recover the costs, but also to cover future costs directly and not just indirectly. The cost of the taxpayer this year is the high point of cost. And an 8-year plan which we see us take the festival into profit in the 7th year from which we started to repay the expenditure to the taxpayer. It would not be easy to predict the period of repayment, but it is not unfair to imagine payments in the following 2 to 3 years. That is long-term planning, Mr. Speaker, which will see us recover not just the 2.25 million, but all the money invested by the taxpayer so far in respect of this event. But this is direct recovery. For all the reasons I have already talked about, it is clear that indirect recovery starts almost immediately, given the huge numbers of visitors and their average expenditure, which I have already mentioned. So, Mr. Speaker, instead of just looking at the headline grabbing, which we have done today, cost, which Mr. Clinton wants to do, and is already done, the House will want to understand the massive wider benefits to Gibraltar and the way in which we have designed the festival in order to ensure that it pays for itself in the context of the business plan we have established. Indeed, with potential sponsorship and other dealings in the offing, it could be that the festival pays for itself sooner and adds even greater benefits to Gibraltar PLC. This is the case with the best chess open tournament in the world, which has attracted 450 participants. The Gibraltar Dark Circle, where 100 participants officials attended, and over 200 spectators to see the tournament. The same can be said with the World Music Festival, the International Song Festival, the Backgammon Festival, the Gibraltar Snooker Championship, the Camping Bowling Tournament, the Glittery Festival, the Jazz Festival, and more. But the value is not that people come to enjoy these events. The real value is that not all, these events are televised, streamed, or programmed and transmitted worldwide. This exposes many different facets of Gibraltar. I will give you an example of the value of these events in relation to coverage these have attracted. The Snooker Championship was televised live on Newsport 1 and 2 for 22 hours of broadcast and had a total reach of 13.6 million viewers throughout the whole of Europe. The Church Festival was reported as the main reported on the main Indian and Chinese channels, as well as CCTV, sports channel, as well as in South African channels. The exposure for Gibraltar since they reported by going to different locations, and it's important that the programs they do go to different locations in Gibraltar, and they film the whole rock. They are actually doing a tourist product program for us. And it's incalculable the value that it has. The exposure to Gibraltar PLC is worth more than placing an advert in those channels, which would cost approximately £20,000 for a 30-second slot. Mr. Speaker, I now move on to sports. The Bayside Sports Complex construction and refurbishment project was completed and inaugurated in March 2016. It consists of a number of areas: the construction and extension of the Bayside Centre to provide a dedicated single-story facility for stay-and-play activities for those with additional needs. The facility was designed for the needs that specifically were in mind, and for a period of consultation with some of the agencies who eventually use the facility. The extension incorporates soft wall finishes, adaptive lighting, and dedicated sanitary facilities incorporating proper equipment. The facility is handed over in time for users for the 2015 Summer Sports Stay and Play program, which during which it was considered a welcome addition to the general facilities of the Bayside Sports Complex. Since then, the extension has been used regularly by the Guardian Angel Foundation. I'm glad to say that they've also used it, they are using it currently very successfully to, this year as well. The relocation of the existing lecture room of the cafeteria of the administration building. These works have been done, have been seen, the relocation of the ground, existing ground floor lecture room to the first floor, together with the additional building. On the ground floor, a basic cell was prepared for the use of the cafeteria, which was subsequently fitted out by the end user. The lecture rooms, boardrooms, were completed by the end of 2015, and since then it has been used by the DSLA and other entities. The provision of a first floor room in the hockey stand by inserting mechanisms in the excessive headroom of the existing shower and sanitary facilities to make best use of the structure. The work included the erection of an external steel walkway stairs and fitted with a lift for all areas to be accessible. These works have required phased working, as only two sanitary facilities could be handed over to the contractor at any one given time. The government welcomed that some association headquarters that were housed in after the pension block, well away from the place where they operate, have now moved to these excellent facilities. They can now administer their sports where they actually practice their sports. The construction of an annex to the original Victoria Stadium main building, as well as some minor conversions to this. The annex comprises three floors, in which one can find, and I won't go through the whole list, but there are things like players, separate rooms, doping control facilities, media centers, TV studios, a central bar facility, VIP lounges, TV camera platforms, additional viewing platforms, and many other things. And I just welcome everybody to go and see it whenever they wish to. I'm sure the software will allow you to go and see it. The annex, now known as the Elizabeth II Sports Annex, was originally conceived as a means of bringing the stadium facilities up to standard to permit specific categories of international football matches to be played. In order to achieve this, the UEFA Stadium's infrastructure regulations were used as the basis for the design brief. However, it is clear that the facilities can be used by any other sporting organization requiring to access such facilities. The building is used several times a week by recreational groups and was recently the organizational center for the Euro Hockey Challenge 3 women's competition, which was hosted locally. In addition, both the basketball and rugby fraternities will make use of the facilities when hosting international events in the very near future. In all areas of work, we have used as we made of LED lighting, much of which controlled by occupation sensors. Which will result in a more efficient use of energy. Apart from this, the annex main water heater system incorporates heat pumps to minimize energy waste. All the areas work have been designed with open access for all and to facilitate this which have been installed. Mr. Speaker, and this is the important aspect of these four projects. These four projects were costed before it was commissioned to the tune of 4.4 million. And I'm glad to report to this house, although I've spent over the one and I'm understanding the other, at least in this case, to the house that the overall cost of the four projects has been approximately 2.9 million. So basically 1.5 million below what was the original cost. The main contractor has been Charles Sands Limited, and the project manager and contract administration and clerk of work roles being provided by the government's technical services department. Mr. Speaker, I now move on to the swimming pool. The major refurbishment work to the renaming of the stability swimming pool started on the 26th of May 2015 and were completed earlier into the summer season the same year. The project included the installation of photovoltaic systems and the dehumidifiers that replaced the previous system, which was getting close to a complete shutdown and was beyond economical repair. It had not received any sort of maintenance since the facilities was inaugurated. The new system has now improved air quality and water temperature maintained that were bordering on inadequate, provided savings in terms of water, electricity, and fuel. Conformed to the Haitian government environmental policies regarding carbon footprint, etc., and reduction to overall maintenance costs. In addition, the interior facilities underwent a much needed refurbishment that included from the pool side, essential refurbishment of changing rooms, reconfiguration of easy access families, changing rooms, replacement of flooring, general facilities. Mr. Speaker, the overall cost of this project was £510,000. However, a third of the cost regarding the air treatment system will be recovered through the European Regional Development Fund, approximately £120,000. Along with the European Union, the project was approved by the EU Secretariat with all applications submitted accordingly. The savings we are currently making will pay for this project within 3 to 4 years. This project is in addition to the one undertaken in the 25-meter pool the previous year, and that has resulted in both pools receiving attention during this administration in office. If you see that solid energy saving is concerned, the combined project has resulted in a production of 368 megahertz of renewable energy as of the 10th of May 2016. In addition, the fact that there is no longer need for diesel fuel as the main source of fuel has also resulted in a reduction of consumption from 36,189 liters of fuel, which in value money was 26,118.11 for the financial year 13-14, to 4,000 liters, which is 3,572.50, in the financial year 14-15, to 1,000 liters, which is 1,000 liters this last financial year, 15-16. So basically, comparing 26,118 every year in fuel, you're now paying 595. And there's no 595 is no necessity because it's a backup just in case the system stops, the photovoltaic price system stops. Thanks to the building pavilion projects were completed and the facilities opened to general public in the summer months. The issues regarding the main pools were solved and the main contractors absorbing the cost. And this resulted in an improved swimming environment with positive feedback received from end users. Improvements have now been made in terms of accessibility to the sea and pools, and the general public will now be able to enjoy a fantastic facility year on year. The government of the Gibraltar via the GSLA have been involved with the following events, both at a logistical and a financial level. At the UEFA Champions League, which we had yesterday and a couple of days, the FIBA Europe Under 18 C Division Champions Women and Men, UEFA Football, World Snooker, Netball Under 17, PDC Dart, TradeWise Chess, which we support and sponsor, the 6th International Junior Chess, the 1st International Backgammon, and that seems to be going very, very successfully this year. We are oversubscribed to that one. The Gibraltar Open, the Gibraltar International Regatta, the Champion Bowling International Dog Show, which I'm sure you all remember, is even involved and likes and gets a lot of help from the GSLA. Harley Davidson Rally, classic vehicle rally, and the Gibraltar Amateur Boxing Association site. Mr. Speaker, I would like to take this opportunity to congratulate the Gibraltar Amateur Boxing Association for hosting a very successful boxing match locally and for their win in this event. In addition, the GSLA offers logistical support and facilities for local sports associations to complete their league and development programs throughout the year, as well as assisting schools in fulfilling their team curriculum both at the Bayside Sports Complex and the GSLA Swimming Pool Complex. Mr. Speaker, the summer sports leisure program 2015 proved to be a great success again. The program ran for 6 weeks and recorded almost 9,000 attendees throughout its different elements. The sports team offered sporting leadership activities every week from morning for 7 to 14 years, and Children's Corner offered appropriate sports and recreational activities 3 days per week for 5 and 6 years. The same play program offers sports, physical, art, and leisure activities for children, especially 5 days a week. The new purpose-built facilities added to the already excellent quality of delivery and the main surroundings with much more comfortable for both children and leaders. The GSLA also works in partnership with the Sports Association, 25 in total, to provide a wide range of sports, coaching courses, and coaching sessions for children and young people. Other positive leisure providers include HM Government Department of Culture and Heritage, RGP, the German Ambulance Guidelines, also offer the children and young people a diverse range of activities, including art and crafts. Mr. Speaker, the government via the GSAC, administered by the GSLA, has continued to support local athletes, teams, when traveling abroad to official international competitions. The GSLA advocates the fact that it's not purely enough to be a member of the international governing body, but the local entities need to be active within them and via participation at events, competitions, and by participating in congresses and annual general meetings. The sports development initiatives have been supported with a view to increase the qualifications, knowledge base, and experience of local coaches and administrators, while some funding has also been provided to associations in order for them to effect vital improvements and adjustments to their facilities. In addition, some individuals have presented cases for financial support under the Elite Athlete Category and have been supported after applications were considered on a case-by-case basis. The cases from the providers under sports grants, and that includes all of them, are £507,979.83. JPLA and GSEC have also been working on revamping and updating the criteria booklet that regulates the funding highlighted above. Particular emphasis has been made on minimum requirements in terms of background checks and police vetting with regard to those who work with young children. The JPLA representative sits on the Child Protection Committee and lessons learned as well as policies implemented in this forum are being adapted to the sporting association and how they are regulated. Mr. Speaker, Alan Wayne, as Minister for Sport and the GSLA, the Ministry for Sport and the GSLA have worked alongside the Gibraltar Islanders Association, GIGA, and supported them in submitting Gibraltar's successful application to host the NatWest Island Games in 2019. An opportunity presented itself after the initial host island pulled out of organizing the games, and GIGA, together with HMGOV, decided to submit the application. Since then, an organizing committee has been formed, subsequent contracts have been signed, and the wheels are firmly set in motion. GIGA and the GSLA have already hosted two visits from the International Island Games Association. The initial familiarization visit was followed by the IIGA Executive Committee decision to hold their annual general meeting in Gibraltar, and subsequently they visited the proposed venue. The feedback received was very positive, and the Executive Committee was particularly impressed with how advanced the local associations are with their respective preparations at this early stage, and how enthusiastic the world in general felt about the game. The GSLA GIGA have already met all the associations who have submitted their initial requirements, and work has started in earnest regarding this aspect of the game. Both the CEO and the GSLA, and the chairperson of GIGA returned from Gotland, where the 2017 Island Games will be held, and gave a presentation to all islands on the Gibraltar Games. They are both confident and satisfied that our facilities and preparations are well scheduled, and that we will be able to produce an excellent game. Mr. Speaker, all in all, last financial year, 15-16, in relation to the portfolios that I am responsible for, the government has been able to fulfill my special commitment. It has also achieved many goals in many areas, and that I have highlighted. For this, I would like to thank all the staff of the ministry, company, authority, and office that I am responsible for. Especially, I would like to thank the staff at the City Hall, who go beyond the call of duty and at times against all odds. Mr. Speaker, the organization and attendance at different events and running ministries like sports, culture, heritage, and youth is not just a 9-to-5 job, but one which heart and soul must be devoted. The management of staff has succeeded to flying colors. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
In order to allow those who supported the arrival in Gibraltar of Lord Monckton's
some years ago, and to demonstrate how right the Honourable Minister for the Environment has always been about climate change, can I invite the House now to recess for a short comfort break and for people to see how badly it's going in summer. And I suppose that we should be back very quickly indeed in 5 to 10 minutes.
We have a set recess. We'll then call upon the Honourable Mr. Edmund Reyes and then the Honourable Marlene Hassan. Call upon the House will adjourn to tomorrow for the Chief Minister to exercise his right to return. I think it's going to be tomorrow at about midday.
Yes, that is my intention. I didn't give on the members.
The Chief Minister will make his right to reply. Then we return at about 3:30 in the afternoon when we go into committee to consider the estimate in detail. Well, I think honourable members are now in a position to make that right for the next today and tomorrow.
And for committee, if only Mr. Clinton and Mr. Osmani want to join up, I think that's going to be a really good idea.
The honourable is in vain.
Mr. Speaker, sir, this happens to be the 9th consecutive year I address this House in what is normally known as the budget session. And in all these 9 addresses, on whatever side of the House I may be set in any particular year, my contributions and the reception dedicated to sport for leisure have always been the most enjoyable at a personal level. As a firm believer in unity where possible for the benefit of the voters' greatest interest, I am glad to see the government continue with a long-existing policy to assist all local sporting bodies to overcome any foreign government politically inspired attempts to block our membership of international sporting bodies. In the past, we have rejoiced together in respect of landmark achievements, and this year we have yet another memorable achievement to rejoice about, namely the acceptance of the Gibraltar Football Association as a full member of FIFA. The policy of assisting sporting associations will certainly continue to receive the opposition's wholehearted support, and I sincerely wish other sporting associations, such as Rugby and even the long-standing claims by the local grant of the IOC, amongst others, all the very best in their continuing battle to obtain the respective international membership, which are rightfully and legally earned. The DSP opposition wishes to support the Football Association all the very best in building its own stadium, especially now that they are moving to an alternative site rather than the other place. I am particularly pleased to hear of the latest developments which indicate that the GFA will receive substantial funding which covers almost the entirety of the costs of building a new UEFA, hopefully Category 3 stadium. However, irrespective of what the GFA does or does not build, the GSD believes there is a need for more and better football facilities to be provided for the benefit of our community at large and across all ages. I believe members of this House should work together in order to provide our football fraternity with adequate facilities in which to train and from where a serious program of youth development may take place. It breaks my heart to see so many football teams having to go into training in order to be able to train and prepare for local and international matches. Indeed, more facilities are very much needed if we are to continue to aspire for getting to the second round and beyond of the qualification stages in respect of the European Champions League and the Europa League, in order to proudly face at home legendary teams such as Scottish champion Celtic and the likes from other countries. Another summer sports season is already upon us, Mr. Speaker, but as yet, the Gibraltar Cricket Association still has no permanent home of its own and has to make do by playing in competitions in the limited and inadequate facilities available at the Europa Point. I urge government to be ever mindful that a level playing field must be provided for all sporting associations, more so as it is a commitment of theirs, and I quote, to monitor the demands for additional facilities for all sports to ensure that existing facilities are developed further in line with our community's needs. The government is committed through its election promises to provide renewed facilities for the playing, teaching and development of both cricket and rugby at the Europa Point area. But unfortunately, these have still not materialised, despite having been first promised through their 2011 election slip for business. Gibraltar is now set to host the Small Island Games once again in 2019, and we look forward to the announcement of the servicemen and or construction of new facilities which will serve our local community beyond the 2019 Games. Mr. Speaker, although I am a firm believer that individual sports governing bodies should be allowed to manage their own affairs with no political interference, I once again urge the Minister for Sport, in his capacity especially as Chairman of the Sports and Leisure Authority, to take a particular interest to ensure that publicly owned facilities are used in a fair manner for the benefit of all sports clubs. There is both a duty and moral obligation for the sports authority to assure that, where desired by a club or individual citizen, membership in their relevant local sports governing body is open to all in an equal and fair manner. I offer myself to sit down and discuss with the Minister for Sport possible avenues which may be looked into in order to set up a special independent body tasked with matters pertaining to and requiring arbitration, especially related to local sporting issues. Some disputes have been dragging on for a bit too long now, and I'm hopeful that by working together with all affected parties, solutions can and should be found. Mr. Speaker, through the collective celebration of social events, participating Gibraltarians contribute towards reinforcing our identity, culture, and history as a people and a community. Both the performing and fine arts fraternities always prove themselves to be very productive within their own specialized areas, and I take this opportunity to congratulate all the groups and individuals who have done Gibraltar extremely proud through their international participation, and especially those numerous cases where we have obtained top grades. It is always a personal and collective pleasure to be able to say how proud we are of the international achievements of our fellow Gibraltarians. During the last summer office, government purchased both the Queen's Cinema and the Queen's Hotel site for the development of the theatre and related activities. However, there are somewhat mixed feelings among the local community as to how these sites will be developed and at what cost. Given the government has pledged to make the old Queen's Cinema complex a venue for touring productions, I sincerely hope that the development of these sites will be a real value for money and that our local culture, in the widest sense of the word, is enhanced. If government can afford to set aside in the estimate $1.5 million, which actually resulted last year in a gross expenditure of $3.6 million, or net of $2.25 million, to subsidize another concert, then surely our local performers and entertainers are entitled to ask for a theatre which is fit for purpose, so that they too may offer live entertainment and in turn develop their own skills. In respect of repairs and refurbishment of government rental homes, what has happened over the last few years is that an ever increasing number of home refurbishments are contracted out to private companies without going through any type of clear, transparent, and accountable tender processes. Unfortunately, feedback from tenants who have had to do work carried out in their homes indicates that at times the quality of the finished product leaves somewhat to be desired. The Ombudsman, in his latest annual report, says that his office continues to face difficulties when seeking information related to work which have been passed by the Housing Authority onto the Gibraltar General Construction Company Limited, which is the entity tasked with repairs to rental housing stock. When the work will be undertaken, or indeed who will carry out the work, is not information available to the Ombudsman directly from DGCC. Sadly, the Ombudsman had to add in his report It is very often a very tedious and difficult exercise to obtain information via the housing manager, who in turn finds it difficult to obtain information or indeed even replies from BBCC. The above situation prevents the Ombudsman from providing a good, efficient service to those who have lost a complaint, which in general are in respect of delay as to when work will be undertaken. Mr. Speaker, these difficulties which the Ombudsman highlights in his report, coincide with the feedback I receive when I meet tenants during clinic night with them. Indeed, I have even had cases where tenants claim to be holding back payment of rent as a sign of protest in respect of the length of time they have been waiting for essential repairs to be carried out in their rental home. Mr. Speaker, the opposition agrees with government that action needed to be taken in order to ensure that all tenants are up to date with any rent due. Indeed, I go further and congratulate the Minister for Housing for having commenced the programme of agreement which will ensure all debtors are up to date with their rent within a given period of time. However, it is also equally just that tenants should have remedial work carried out to an acceptable standard and within a reasonable period of time. If the Ombudsman finds it difficult to get answers to his questions, one can only imagine what it is like for a tenant trying to obtain any answers directly by himself. Mr. Speaker, both the Ombudsman and Action for Housing have expressed concern at the manner in which housing allocations are currently being made. Government has a 2011 manifesto commitment to provide a home to everyone on the housing waiting list and on the pre-list as of the 9th of December 2011, all that to happen before the next general election. The pledge was to eliminate the then existing waiting list and pre-list. Unfortunately, this target was not met by the time the 2015 elections came along, and from the statistics available in January 2016, there were still 413 applicants waiting the allocation of a home despite their names having been on the waiting list prior to the 9th of December 2011. The government's website that gives a breakdown with statistics per department was last updated in February with figures in respect of housing matters, and that is the figures as of the end of January 2016. This information is therefore now 6 months old, and I would welcome an update of statistics, which I know and hope Mr. Speaker would also appreciate, as it pertains questions which I otherwise have to pose at question time, and these questions are purely of a statistical nature. Based on the January 2016 figures, there were 1,566 applicants on the waiting list, with an additional 520 on the pre-list, giving us a grand total of 2,086 applicants. As of January 2016, the Minister for Housing informed his House that he expected 21 rental homes to be returned to the Housing Authority upon completion of all co-ownership homes. Given the extremely small number of rental homes which will become available to applicants who cannot afford to purchase co-ownership homes, I recommend the government takes a serious look at constructing new rental homes, not just for senior citizens, worthy of his rights, but we must address the housing needs of all current applicants. The opposition has suggested prior to the last general elections that rent in respect of rental homes should be means-tested. Therefore, we note and welcome the views expressed from the Ombudsman that there should be periodical reviews of rental charges. Not everyone is able to obtain a mortgage and therefore purchase their own home through the co-ownership scheme. However, there are many who do, and yet they opt out of purchasing, knowing that the monthly rent are a token when compared to the level of their personal wages. Mr. Speaker, many new homeowners have expressed to me their sense of unfairness, as the only way in which they could obtain a home in keeping with the family requirement was through co-ownership, and this in turn brings with it new financial burdens. The claim of unfairness is that not only do we now have a mortgage to pay or say around £200 a month for an average two-bedroom home, but they additionally have to pay community fees or service charges, which at current rates is even greater than what the government rental tenants pay in rent per month. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, there are more and more people asking why should the taxpayer have to subsidize rental homes, given that the annual cost of expenditure for upkeep of these homes is greater than the sum received from rent due. Mr. Speaker, I would be grateful if government were able to explain why, despite the recently announced increases in house rent, of which no notice of intention to introduce increases were given at election time, the estimated revenue under this heading for 2016-2017 is now estimated to be from a net of £2.9 million to about £300,000 only, therefore less than the forecast last year. Likewise, Mr. Speaker, given that six rental housing estates have been recently mortgaged by government, can these tenants be enlightened as to whether they remain government tenants or are a new landlord now a company or some other entity? Mr. Speaker, there are now many libertarians who have very recently moved into a new co-ownership home. I have had an opportunity to see some of these homes myself, and I'm happy to report that many aspects of these new constructions are very welcomed by the new owners. However, there are some aspects which I would like to bring to the government's attention in the hope that the relevant minister will be able to look into this further. Mr. Speaker, numerous purchasers of deep sea terraces have brought to my attention their concerns in respect of the quality and reliability of the lifts installed. A recent example of why the new lifts already give cause for concern is the unfortunate frequency with which they seem to break down. I sincerely hope that this will be looked into with some priority, and that, likewise, proper monitoring during installation of lifts at the existing rental estate which are currently having refurbishment will be monitored as and when the lifts are being installed. Before I conclude, Mr. Speaker, I would like to ask the Honourable Minister to spare some time and look into new problems which have arisen within some homes in the state where refurbishments are presently being undertaken. I have received information from a few tenants, some were photographic evidence, showing that as a result of the flooding and installation of new roofs, they are now suffering from water ingress, an issue which had never occurred in the many years they have been living in the same home. In wishing the Minister all the best and hoping that the refurbishment works are completed on time, as per the schedule she has already provided to answer the questions I have posed in this House, I appeal to her that new remedial works, such as those I have just given examples of, are also completed within the same time span as all major works are due to be finished. Mr. Speaker, the Chief Minister has already in the past given a public indication that he will carry out a reshuffle of ministerial responsibilities at some stage after this year's budget session. In anticipation of this, I wish to restate, as I have done on previous occasions, I restate to all my colleagues currently sitting on the government benches, in particular those ministers with whom I will have the honour and privilege to shadow, that I remain always ready to work immediately within this House when embarking upon reasonable, responsible, and above all, affordable initiatives so that together we improve the quality of life of this precious community of ours. I sincerely hope government will accept this genuine offer of mine in the spirit it is intended. Mr. Speaker, I know I repeat myself as in previous years, but I cannot sit down without thanking you, the clerk, and all the staff here behind the scenes, because although the general public rightly thinks that parliamentary work is the receptions that they are able to follow through the media, a lot of work does happen on days when it's not official sitting, and especially in radio positions can be a bit of what they say, depending on the next when we come here and people asking the clerk for information and so on. So, Mr. Speaker, I thank them all, and especially thank the clerk for that we just to take the care of you all.
Honourable Madeleine Hassan-Town.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, before I commence my address, my young son has told me that I must mention today here in Parliament last night's event at our very own Victoria Stadium, where the devoted champion Lincoln managed to win their first round game and are now going against Celtic from Scotland. This is a great achievement, and we will now be able to host Scottish fans in what I hope will be a great event for Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, it seems that since the referendum results, Gibraltar and Scotland seem to be making huge strides together. Mr. Speaker, it is an honour for me to rise to deliver my first budget speech as an independent Member of Parliament. When I was first sworn in as a member of this House, I felt not only a strong sense of privilege, but also one of immense responsibility in keeping with this chamber's long and close association with the history of democracy in Gibraltar. And it is with the confidence of the mandate that was given to me at the last general election that I stand here today, determined as ever to meet these responsibilities as a minority member, as indeed a number of independent parliamentarians have done before me. It is a passionate commitment to the people of Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker, that I hope to reflect in myself. And it is in this spirit that I would like to state my first response to the government's budget. This budget, and its reflection, Mr. Speaker, follows a bruising Brexit campaign and result. The conviction to remain part of the EU unified people of Gibraltar across political party lines, religions, and economic sectors, across all traditional divides. Now that the result is known, it is important for Gibraltarians to focus their attention on its growth engine, the economy. It is a time to work with the government of Gibraltar in its quest to find the best solutions for a post-Brexit Gibraltar. Until the UK itself comes into solid ground, though, as to what are the effects and new stipulations of a Brexit within the EU, any pretense that there is a clear policy to offer with regard to Gibraltar's place going forward would be purely speculative. While talks and ideas for a redefining of the UK is underway, I wish to add that I have no doubt, Mr. Speaker, that Gibraltar will continue to thrive and reinvent itself as it has always done in order to move forward with the times and continue to be a successful economy for generations to come. We have seen this so often in our history, and this latest challenge, Mr. Speaker, should be no different. Mr. Speaker, I am aware that there will be some overlap with what has been discussed this week. However, I am hopeful that my unique position will offer a different insight. I would like to start with the people of Gibraltar, for whom the budget has a direct impact on their daily lives. I am glad to report that my invitation to Gibraltarians to provide me with their issues and queries was heeded by many concerned citizens. As I have committed, I will start with some of the main concerns and comments. I will, in due course, be sending a letter to the Chief Minister in which I will articulate their suggestions and concerns. Mr. Speaker, over the years, Gibraltar has seen a state of lifts being installed in many estates around the world. I am pleased for those in our community who are now finding mobility easier as a result of these lifts being installed. However, I have been made aware that such facility has not yet been extended those living in many areas of Gibraltar. I was recently approached by residents of Sandpit House, where many are struggling up and down flights of steps while they wait for the promise of a lift to be materialized. As people living in these estates get older, Mr. Speaker, and their mobility is reduced, so is their independence as a result of this delay, something which is greatly affecting their quality of life. I therefore call on government, Mr. Speaker, to honour their manifesto commitments and complete the installation of lifts in estates around Gibraltar as soon as possible and within the 2016-2017 financial year. With regard to the cemetery and its upkeep, Mr. Speaker, it has also been brought to my attention that people are aggrieved for the condition in which their beloved friends and relatives are lying to rest. People would like to know whether there is a structured maintenance program in the cemetery. And although I do know to the Honourable Member, Minister Johnford, just saying yesterday that there was a plan and structure in hand, I'm sorry to say that But up until now, the cemetery has not been dealt with by way of priority. Mr. Speaker, we really are the caring society that we purport to be. We need to be reflecting this by restoring dignity to our cemetery, a place of peace, solace, and comfort, as a matter of urgency. Mr. Speaker, I will, if I may, now touch upon the topic of taxes, which is another issue that is distressing many in our community. Some of those who are in arrears, others who employers are not paying their taxes for them, and a few who are waiting for their rebate. On the 7th of June, arrears stood at 28.71 million, or 4.86% of government estimated revenue for 2015-2017. Since first being published for 2011, the tax arrears for individuals have remained fairly static. The breakdown only provides for four categories, namely individuals, self-employed, companies, and payaways, and does not afford an understanding of the age debtors. In order to gain a sense of how realistic the expectation would be for government to be able to collect the tax arrears, I call on the government to release a schedule of age debtors. From my dealings with many employees, I have a particular concern with payaways, which is withholding tax on income payments to employees. As I understand, payaway means that the tax is deducted by the employer from its employee's salary, but not paid over to government. This means that on March 31st, 51.72% of taxpayers were attributable to companies. Is there a relation between the company taxpayers and payaway arrears? As I understand it, the collection of payaway is a function that government transfers to companies, so companies act as their agents. So if the companies do not pay over the payaway, the payaway that they have effectively taken, they have effectively taken money due to government. What sanctions does government impose on these companies in these instances? And Mr. Speaker, during last week's Chief Minister's questions and answers, the Honourable Member, the Chief Minister, alerted this House to the fact that £30 million is owed in refunds to the taxpayer. Various people over the last few months have approached me with a view to voicing their need to receive these rebates, something I believe would be forthcoming in the not-too-distant future, or that it wouldn't be an issue, Mr. Speaker. However, after noting that the government has only budgeted £10 million for the current financial year on to allocate for rebates, I have to ask on what basis can this be justified. Last year, £7 million was budgeted for rebates, but even then, £560,000 was held back from being returned. Is this the new and improved rebate mechanism put in place, I ask? There is no excuse for the delay in refunding people's money. Mr. Speaker, especially when the funds are extortionate and in effect being borrowed by government but not included as part of its public debt. A public debt figure which would have broken the legal limit approved by this House had it been accounted for. Mr. Speaker, I ask government, would not rebating at this rate inevitably compound the rebate amount while people await their money indefinitely? Mr. Speaker, this to me seems unfair on the public and unfair on the staff at the Income Tax Office, whose will to solve the problem is stifled due to government budgetary decisions. And having said that, Mr. Speaker, I hope that there is or will be a process in place to ensure that people who are in arrears on their end do not get a refund which would not be due to them. And on the subject of rent, Mr. Speaker, I am pleased to note the increase, however small it may be, on rental charges, but hope that government has thought through a mechanism to ensure how those in arrears will be complying with such a rise as well as paying those outstanding arrears. I also hope that government intends to have annual or regular increases in rent to catch up for the last few decades. At this point, I think it is important to recognize the work of the Honourable the Minister for Housing for working tirelessly and firmly to decrease housing arrears and putting this mechanism into place, something that needed to be done desperately, but a thankless task that is not easy or popular to see through. On the subject of arrears, Mr. Speaker, we haven't even begun to discuss arrears in electricity, which actually stand higher than rental arrears at over £6.6 million. I call on government to explain to this House how it plans to retrieve this other large arrears fund. As highlighted, Mr. Speaker, the general feedback I have been receiving, the feedback that matters, the feedback from our community, is in part the result of my shout-out through my press release of June 6th, stating that it is important that the parents from all walks of life be involved in and are able to participate in the compilation of the budget. An interactive budget is more than just cameras and extra parliamentary sessions, Mr. Speaker. What is important is that eligible parents should understand the budgetary process and for their voices to be heard. No contribution should ever be trivialized or rejected out of hand. It is with this intent that I am pursuing my choice that this and all future budgets honor the trilogy of evaluation, namely transparency, accountability, and privacy. In addition, the budget should be acknowledged as a living document. It should be a process rather than an event. Following its delivery, we should not need to wait 12 months for another. I am proposing and calling for the introduction of a biennial budget review, a six-month review, if you will. The United Nations adopts such a budgetary process, its Office of Program Planning, Budgets and Accounts. This budgetary process allows the UN to implement, monitor, evaluate and provide feedback on the budget. Similarly, in the UK, we see each year what is known as an autumn statement, sometime in November or December, when the Council of the Exchequer provides an update on the government's plan for the economy based on the latest forecast from the Office for Budget Responsibility. In a world where the only constant is change, we no longer have the luxury to wait 12 months, Mr. Speaker. The budgetary process needs to be as resilient as eligible parents are. Mr. Speaker, while on the subject of planning and interaction, this House will recall the Chief Minister's announcement on May 4, 2015 of the creation of an Economic Advisory Council named Gibraltar 2025 in Partnership to assist the government in its development of a 10-year strategic economic plan in partnership with the private sector and unions. More than a year has passed since this announcement, so I would ask the Chief Minister to give us an update on the progress of this council. Mr. Speaker, let me offer my reflection on observation on Gibraltar's tax base. According to the estimates book, import duties and income tax are estimated at £150 million apiece, or collectively at 50.78% of total revenue. Company tax is estimated at £105 million, and inclusive of customs duty and income tax, it equates to £405 million, or 68.55% of total revenue. Should one add group practice medical scheme of £25 million, these four taxes equate to 77.35% of total revenue. There are 110 revenue items, so three, or 1.82% of the revenue items, accounts for 77.35% of total revenue. It is quite evident, Mr. Speaker, that Gibraltar has a very narrow tax base. Though this ought to be of concern to all of those homes, more concerning is that very little is, for instance, known about the nature and extent of the revenue collected by means of import duties, the tax on imports. The most recent import statistics are for 2014 as contained in the Abstract of Statistics 2014, which was released in December 2015. However, there are few concerns with this data set. For one, and I quote, the source data for 2014 is incomplete and will be revised once all the declarations have been processed by HM Customs, unquote. The 2015 data set is as yet not available. The parcel data set then also excludes petroleum products. Why is that? Then there are no statistics as to the products being imported, nor of the aggregate import duties that they attract. So imports tend to be a closed book, despite, as mentioned by the Chief Minister, a substantial growth in customs staff. I call on government to release more detailed import and export statistics, as do I require clarification as to how, for instance, government is able to budget for import duties when these data sets are not complete. I must say, however, Mr. Speaker, it was refreshing to note the government's removal of import duty on nappies, tampons, and sanitary towels. While I, and I think I speak for all women in Gibraltar between the ages of 12 and 50, congratulate the government on their decision to eliminate import duty on these essential items, lament the fact that this is necessary in the first place, it is well comforting to see, Mr. Speaker, that these vital products are no longer considered luxury items and that they are no longer bunched up in the same category as hair extensions. And, Mr. Speaker, now to government companies. Wholly owned government companies are normally confined to page X in the published approved government and Gibraltar estimates of revenue and expenditure for a given financial year. I call on government to publish and include additional pages containing the names of all companies in which the government has an interest, inclusive of minority shareholding, and also for all commissions and agencies which it has established. If past practice is anything to go by, then the estimates book will contain the standard diagram of the government companies wholly owned. In essence, it consists of two holding companies, namely Gibraltar Investment Holdings and Gibraltar International Bank. The expenditure item contribution to government-owned companies accounts for 4.99% of total expenditure, or $25 million. So what do we know about these companies? Where are the revenue and expenditure reflected? Would one not expect it to form part of the budget? Then, do these companies submit annual returns, and if so, to whom? And are these annual returns available for public scrutiny? Do we know if these companies have boards? If so, who are the members of these boards, and what is their remuneration to serve in such capacity? Also, to who are these board members and companies accountable to, and what is the sanction if they do not fulfill their mandate? These are but some of the questions which I call on government to clarify and answer in the name of transparency, accountability, and probity. I would have expected, Mr. Speaker, that since the government is allocating expenditure, which is essentially the redirection of revenue to these companies, mainly in the figure of $25 million as announced for this year, that these companies should have accountability to this house. And while having just dealt with government companies, wholly owned government companies, of which this house has at the very best very little, if any, financial information, in the Chief Minister's address a couple of days ago, yet another has been created via Gibraltar Capital Assets Limited, a newly incorporated subsidiary of the Gibraltar Development Corporation. This latest development, the £300 million new institutional investment, raises many more questions and a matter which I ask government to provide more details on to this House. Mr. Speaker, I would like to clarify exactly what this is so the man on the street understands in no uncertain terms that when the Honourable Chief Minister refers to institutional investment of $300 million, what he in fact is referring to is a long-term loan, additional government borrowing of £300 million secured against six government estates where ordinary people live. In short, a massive mortgage. So the question is, on what terms has government entered into an agreement of this magnitude, and is it right to commit future generations to such an agreement? I call on government to inform this House how this structure works, inclusive of the source of finance for a payment. In addition, I would also ask government to explain to the thousands of returns what would happen in the event of the government defaulting on any of its commitments. Because, Mr. Speaker, in the trying times facing Gibraltar, people want to and need to feel safe about our nation's financial arrangements and decisions. So more disclosure on this latest agreement would be very welcome. I also ask government to explain to this House and to the people of Gibraltar how it could enter into an agreement without consultation of this House, an agreement that binds Gibraltar for such a long period of time. A period of time that would conceivably extend well beyond this administration's term of office. Although the government might profess this to be a better strategy than selling off these prize assets, Mr. Speaker, what it is doing is to borrow against these prize assets while acting as facilitator employing a wholly owned government company whose finances are not reported to or receiving the scrutiny of this House. This is why I ask for clarification as to why money needs to be raised, particularly in light of the recurring budget surpluses that the government has been recording and the glowing testimonial given on the performance of the economy. Mr. Speaker, people are asking me why is an amount as large as £300 million required, an amount equivalent to 50.78% of estimated revenue for 2016-2017. Is the intention to use the full amount and accept the net public debt of £345 million? Why is this amount needed, particularly when the Chief Minister in his address stated that, and I quote, we have the liquidity necessary to deal with the issues that do confront us, and we have the liquidity necessary to deal with the issues that could confront us. I await the Chief Minister's answers to all these questions. Mr. Speaker, on a personal note, and to recap what I have been doing in the last 7 months since being elected to Parliament, I would like to remind you and the House of a few of my endeavours. In education, I have highlighted concerns by teachers and parents, ranging from the practical to logistical, questioning manifesto commitments, which have now turned into consultation exercises, like school lunches, to matters of work, safety and security in the new schools that we eagerly await to be refilled. Likewise in health, I have brought to the House people's concerns with the current system at the primary care centre and St. Bernard Hospital, as well as those of doctors, for example, in connection to the upcoming implementation of the General Medical Council, a dynamic and ambitious move, but one that sadly I feel has not been properly put through and could have negative repercussions for the health authorities if we don't get it absolutely right. In general, Mr. Speaker, I have spent much of my time talking to, but most importantly, listening to constituents and bringing their causes and concerns to government, this House, and responsible bodies. And on that note, I would like to take this opportunity to thank the Minister for Health for collaborating with me when he has been able to do so, for having always given me the time to present to him the cases that I have come across in shadowing the health portfolio and listening to the constituents who have approached me needing action to be taken. To this day, the Honourable Member, the Minister for Health, has always been willing to help me, to help others, and I thank him for this. I would like to see more cross-party collaboration for the good of the average Gibraltarian who needs to be heard and helped. In order to in future facilitate a more conducive and productive budget deliberation, I call on the government to next year release the full copy of the draft government of the voter estimate of revenue and expenditure 2017-2018 to this House, including the information it provides in the copy, which is only subsequently published for public consumption. In accordance with my commitment to foster a culture of open budgets, I have written to a number of international institutions who champion this cause. I believe that much could be gained from Gibraltar being an active participant in these initiatives. I call on the government to adopt a biennial budget review, making it a living document, increasing transparency and including all government companies, wholly owned, joint ventures, agencies and commissions in a single government budget presented to this House. By way of conclusion, Mr. Speaker, I want to reiterate that I still have a responsibility to the electorate to form part of an effective opposition that is so essential to the democratic process. Mr. Speaker, I want to work in partnership with the majority party in opposition to hold the government to account. But for me, it is also important to hold the majority opposition to account when I feel that their sense of perspective may be distorted. And Mr. Speaker, I would like to remind the people of Gibraltar that I am here as their voice in Parliament to represent them and bring their causes and concerns to this House and to try and help the vulnerable and those in need in any way I can. I would also thank the Leader of the Opposition, the Chief Minister, the Clerk of the House and his wonderful staff, and in particular you, Mr. Speaker, for helping me ease into my first year as a parliamentarian. And despite the upheavals between myself and some of my former colleagues, I would like to reassure them that they, as well as all other members of the House, shall remain on my Christmas tablet. If there are any doubts to my loyalties, Mr. Speaker, then I would like to make it clear that my loyalties today as there have always been, as to democracy, to this house, and to the people of Jaboy.
Well, Mr. Speaker, after hearing a veteran give his contribution and hearing a maiden give her contribution, which sounded very much like a veteran's contribution, I now propose that we adjourn to tomorrow at midday when I will exercise my right to reply to everybody else.
I will now adjourn to tomorrow at 12 noon.